You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
When it comes to the realization that the United States is supporting both sides, one then understands that this is not an internal conflict. It is a war of aggression, which consists in destabilizing a nation state, implementing regime change, and ultimately also establishing an American colony which previously was under the hegemony of the French Republic.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Michelle Chosorowski. Today's show, The War on Mali. Who are the major actors? Michelle Chosorowski is professor of economics and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, based in Montreal, Quebec. He is the author of The Globalization of Poverty and the New World Order, War and Globalization, The Truth Behind September 11th, and America's War on Terrorism. Today we discuss the French intervention in Mali within the broad historical context of post-World War II geopolitics. Who is really recolonizing the African continent? The history, economy, and natural resources of Mali, covert war, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, the Tuareg, a pattern of using so-called terrorist organizations to carry out U.S. foreign policy, the early 1980s Canadian study of Mali, the IMF and World Bank reforms, and finally the hostage crisis at an Algerian natural gas complex. Michelle Chosorowski, welcome.
I'm delighted to be on the program.
France has sent troops to Mali in northwest Africa, as well as having conducted airstrikes over its former colony. In March of 2012, there was a military coup d'etat in Mali. Let's start with the coup of 2012. What do we know about this coup?
Well, the coup was led by a junior officer. It was an act of rebellion within the armed forces against the government, leading to the toppling of that government and the appointment of a provisional government. It's unclear as to who was behind this coup. The author of the coup, the young captain of 39 years old, career military officer, was trained in the United States. One suspects that this could have been a U.S.-sponsored coup, but we have no firm evidence to that effect. What occurred is essentially a structure of instability, namely the appointment of a transitional president. The duly elected president stepped down, and a new government was appointed. So it was, in essence, regime change.
First, we have the French leading an intervention in Libya and now Mali. How is this military intervention going to affect France? And why do you believe France is intervening?
Well, let me put it perhaps in a broader historical perspective. French West Africa was, from the turn of the 20th century, starting in the early 1900s, was a tremendous, vast territory extending across the continent. It was not the best territories of the African continent which went to the British. But nonetheless, from a geopolitical standpoint, we're talking about an empire, and that whole region was in the French sphere of influence. It was called the French Sudan. Now, upon achieving independence in the late 50s, early 60s, Mali got its independence in 1960, these countries essentially remained within the French sphere of influence. They had a common currency system, which was the CFA franc, which was tied to the French franc. And essentially, France was the neo-colonial power. The economies of these countries didn't change fundamentally. Mali continued to export cotton through a state enterprise, which was called Compagnie Malienne des Textiles, which replaced the former colonial company, which was called Compagnie Française des Textiles. But in effect, it was essentially a shift in name. The French still controlled, ultimately, the mainstay of the Malian economy. Now, recent reports have suggested that France, and I'm talking about critical progressive reports pointing to France's military intervention in Mali, what they are saying is that now France is recolonizing its former territories. This interpretation, I think, has to be analyzed and questioned. France has been the major colonial power in that region, and starting, I would say, in the 1980s and perhaps even the early 90s, French influence started to be eroded, essentially to the benefit of the United States of America. And that happened when the CFA franc collapsed in the early 90s. It also was the result of the imposition of macroeconomic reforms under the IMF and the World Bank. And increasingly, France's influence and colonial hegemony was eroded and questioned. And the countries in West Africa started to establish much closer ties with the USA. In other words, when we say this is a reconquest or this is a recolonization of Africa, that region has always been under colonial influence. But what is now occurring is that that colonial influence is gradually moving from France to a new colonial power, which is the United States of America. And unless we understand that logic, we won't understand what's going on in Mali. It's a historical process. It's not limited to Africa, whereby the United States takes over the colonies of other European powers. It was the basis of the Spanish-American War in the late 19th century, where the Philippines was transferred to the United States. It was, to some extent, also tied into World War II, where the United States took over countries which were within the Japanese sphere of influence, not to mention the transfer of Indonesia, which was a Dutch colony, into the hands of the United States, essentially as a proxy state. But with regard to France, France lost its colonies in Asia, Indochina, namely Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos, which today are de facto U.S. proxy states, their colonies. It's within the U.S. sphere of influence. French is no longer spoken. More recently, in the 1990s, Rwanda, which was not a French colony, but which in the wake of its independence became inserted within the French sphere of influence. It was a Francophone country. It had very close bilateral ties with France. From one day to the next, following the Rwandan genocide and the support granted by the United States to the insurrection led by Paul Kagame, trained at Fort Leavenworth, Rwanda is now becoming an English-speaking African country, and it is within the U.S. sphere of influence. The same thing goes for the Congo. When Laurent Désiré Kabila, who was a leftist militant in the 1960s. He was brought back. He led the insurrection against the Mobutu government. He installed a government. Who was he supported by? The United States of America. And essentially what is happening is an encroachment of French colonial territories in Africa by an upcoming colonial power, because historically, of course, Africa had been divided up at the Berlin Conference in the late 19th century between the various European powers. America was not part of that redivision of Africa. So bear in mind now that the United States is increasing its sphere of influence in North Africa. Of course, Libya is it's already established, but it's also within the other countries, Algeria, Morocco, Tunisia. There was a plan to establish a secret U.S. military base in southern Algeria, right at the border with Mali. And in fact, it was being built by Kellogg Brown and Root, a subsidiary of Halliburton. And that program was scrapped, resulting from opposition within Algeria to establishing a U.S. military presence on Algerian soil. But essentially, the U.S. agenda is to confiscate that whole area, okay, extending right across the continent from the Sudan through the Sahelian belt, Egypt, Libya, the Central African Republic, Chad, Mali, Mauritania. That whole belt is now gradually being taken over by the United States. We see the deployment of AFRICOM, U.S. AFRICOM in Africa, the sending in of special forces into 35 African countries. And when we see these actions by France, we must understand that it's not France which is conquering Africa. It is the United States using France as a proxy, and the result of which will be the weakening of France within French Africa.
Well, Michelle, I was going to ask you, why would France help the U.S. take over its former colonies?
Well, I think that there's several lines of understanding of that question. First of all, in recent years, the United States has had an overriding role in influencing political appointments in the French Republic. I think that the presidency of Jacques Chirac was, in essence, was a watershed. Sarkozy is a U.S. appointee, was a U.S. appointee. And there's a whole background behind it. His family links to the CIA, his stepfather, who was a major CIA official, and his support of U.S. interests. The same thing is true of Bernard Kouchner, with foreign minister under the Sarkozy government. And it seems that his successor, François Hollande, is ultimately also serving U.S. interests. But I should mention that they are serving U.S. interests, but at the same time, they are anxious to share the spoils of war. Northern Mali is an area of tremendous wealth. Okay, these are wealthy countries. They're wealthy countries in terms of resources. They're resource economies. The Congo is a resource economy with minerals, with oil and strategic metals. Mali is a major gold producer. There's uranium in Niger. The uranium is controlled by France. The United States wants to control those areas. There's oil, there's natural gas, there's gold. But at the same time, it's a geopolitical belt across the entire continent.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, The War on Mali. Who are the major actors? I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. What was the ancient civilization in Mali? Was it a center of trade?
If we go back in history, of course, Mali is an ancient civilization. It was the crossroads of the trans-Saharan trade, linking the Mediterranean to West and Southern Africa. There was also an East-West trade. Mali had trade with China from across the continent and then across the Indian Ocean. And it has a long history. Timbuktu was a historical city. They said it was paved in gold. It was a center of learning. The University of Timbuktu was one of the earlier universities of the Muslim world, of Muslim scholarship. And so that is the background. First of all, Mali is not an independent sovereign country. And it is still within the French sphere of influence as far as the civilian administration is concerned, the government. These are very highly educated civil servants, many of them trained in France. But I would suspect that now the military is much more influenced by the United States. And in the course of the last, I would say in the course of the last 20 years, 30 years, sorry, since the early 80s, these countries, Mali in particular, have been under the brunt of IMF, World Bank reforms, subjected to the usual doses of economic medicine with emphasis on developing the export economy at the detriment of local production. This is also a country which has endemic famines. It's not to say that they can't produce food. They can. The Niger Valley is a tremendous waterway where you can cultivate and feed your own population. But in effect, the Niger Valley is used for cash crops. Cotton is Mali's major export. All those factors, the economic factors, the geopolitical inroads of the United States have, on the one hand, they've impoverished these countries beyond bounds, but at the same time, they've weakened the ties which West Africa had with the French Republic.
Has there been a covert war underway in Mali for some time?
Well, precisely. I think that if we want to understand the logic of these insurrections, we have to know who is behind them. We have several powerful actors which are supporting the insurrection in northern Mali. As far as the Islamists are concerned, the so-called Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, which is leading the war against the Malian armed forces. It is known and documented that Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, AQIM, is supported by the Gulf monarchies, a heritage of Wahhabi Salafist ideology funded by Qatar and Saudi Arabia and supported covertly by the CIA. That's something which is well documented, that Al-Qaeda-affiliated organizations are supported covertly by the CIA, going back to the Soviet-Afghan war. Essentially, what is happening is that Al-Qaeda in Islamic Maghreb is creating conditions of destabilization and sectarian divisions within these countries. And the irony is that while they're supported covertly by U.S. intelligence, but also French intelligence is involved as well. They are also fighting against these French forces which have been sent in. So that we're in a very complex situation. There's an insurrection in the north. It's the Tuareg insurrection, but then there's also this Islamists, and we're led to believe that this is a civil war, but in effect, it's not a civil war. It is an insurrection which is led by Islamic groups, and those Islamic groups are supported covertly by the Western powers, and particularly the United States, and to a lesser extent, France. And that kind of involvement of the United States in supporting al-Qaeda in different regions of intervention is well understood. They're doing the same thing in Somalia. However, I should mention that al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb is still an entity in its own right. The United States probably would call this an intelligence asset because they will fund it covertly through the Emirates, through the Wahhabi missions in Saudi Arabia, through Qatar. They will not necessarily be directly involved. But that form of support is well understood. Now, interestingly enough, in the wake of the war on Libya, the so-called Libya Islamic Fighting Group, which is an al-Qaeda-affiliated organization trained in Afghanistan in CIA camps, and that's well documented. Its leaders were, in fact, in Afghanistan, and the CIA did at one time support them. But we also know that the Libya Islamic Fighting Group, during the NATO-led operations, were, in fact, the foot soldiers of the Western Military Alliance, which were used to topple Gaddafi. And we know also that they were in liaison with NATO, that they had, including, they even had British special forces on the ground helping them, advising them. So that the Libya Islamic Fighting Group is, well, they are an instrument of the Western Military Alliance. They were subsequently also sent to Syria, acting as terrorists within the Free Syrian Army. So they're trained mercenaries. And now we find contingencies of Libya Islamic Fighting Group within the ranks of the various, whether it's not only Akim, there's also another organization called Ansar-e-Din, which is also a jihadist group. And these mercenaries then integrate these formations in Algeria and Mali, but they are financed, supported covertly by the United States through various means. In this case, it was even documented by the French media that Qatar was providing support to the Islamic rebels in Algeria and northern Mali.
Yes. Now, but weren't the Tuareg, the people from northern Mali, weren't they supporters of Colonel Gaddafi during the NATO attack on Libya? Are the Tuareg in northern Mali now militarized due to the Libyan war?
My understanding is that the Tuaregs, I mean, the Tuaregs have been marginalized. Within Mali, they've been marginalized. They're nomadic people which move across borders, and they never really had any rights within Mali. And certainly there were Tuaregs who then joined this movement. But I think that since then, the Tuaregs have, their movement has been infiltrated by the jihadists, and this has given a different flavor to the nature of this insurrection. I'm not entirely clear as to the evolving relationship between the Tuareg movement on the one hand and the Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. In some regards, they've joined forces, and in other regards, they are in conflict.
I see. So, but then there is a pattern of using clearly terroristic organizations, even those listed as so by the U.S. State Department, to carry out U.S. foreign policy?
Well, absolutely. The Al-Qaeda-affiliated organizations are supported by, they're supported by the United States. And we've seen that even in Iraq, okay? When we saw Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Now, Al-Qaeda in Iraq was a jihadist organization which didn't even exist prior to the U.S. invasion. But then it was created. You had the Al-Zarqawi phenomenon. Al-Zarqawi was ultimately killed. And then you had subsequent formation of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And I should mention another thing which I think is very important. In 2005, John Negroponte was sent to Iraq as ambassador, as U.S. ambassador. His main task during a very short stint of less than 2 years was to set up the Shia and Kurdish death squads, which would essentially be used to commit atrocities very much on what was called the Salvador option in Latin America. Negroponte had been in charge of the death squads in Honduras as well as the Contras in Nicaragua in the early 1980s. And he was sent to Iraq to set up the Iraqi death squads. And it's fairly well documented as to the role of these death squads. But one of the persons on his team was Robert Stephen Ford, a senior U.S. State Department official who joined him as he was more or less number two in the Negroponte team. He joined him at the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad in 2005. He's a man who speaks fluent Arabic and Turkish, and he made the contacts with the various groups, the Mahdi Army and the Badr group and so on in Iraq. And he was then appointed in 2006. That was his stint in Iraq was relatively short. It was about 2 years from 2004 to 2006. In 2006, he was appointed to Algeria as ambassador. And I mean, the matter needs to be investigated, but the fact is that Robert Stephen Ford was appointed to the Negroponte team in 2004-2005. Then he goes to Algeria as ambassador at a time when the various jihadist groups started to integrate. And it was at that moment that we see the emergence of Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, which was essentially the coalescence of several jihadist groups, and jihadist groups which had existed historically in Algeria for quite some time. So that to what extent Robert Stephen Ford played a role in pushing for the integration of what was previously called the GSPC, in French, it's the Groupe Salafiste pour la Prédication et le Combat. It was something which existed from the 1970s. It was a Salafist group, and then it more or less got integrated into this Al Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, which was really far more of a CIA supported entity than previously. And it coincided with the appointment of Robert Stephen Ford. I should say Robert Stephen Ford then became ambassador to Syria. Okay?
I was about ready to mention that.
Yes. He was number two man at the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. Then in 2006, he goes to Algeria. And then he goes back to Baghdad in 2008. And in 2010, he's sent to Syria. And he also played a similar role as a liaison with the Free Syrian Army. Now, so that you have a group of State Department officials. There was another person on the Negroponte team who then went to when Robert Stephen Ford was reassigned back to Baghdad. Then they appointed another member of the same team to go and succeed Robert Stephen Ford as ambassador in Algeria. So what I'm saying is that the position of ambassador, of U.S. ambassador in Algeria, is very crucial in spearheading these various intelligence operations. And Robert Stephen Ford, I don't doubt that he must have played a very important role in Algeria in the 2 year stint between 2006-2008. We saw the emergence of Al-Qaeda in Maghreb from various other organizations which existed previously.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, The War on Mali. Who are the major actors? I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. What can you tell us about the study you did for the Canadian government in the early 1980s? You spent a lot of time in Mali then and wrote a 400-page report.
Well, when this crisis erupted, I recalled my earlier work that I had done in Mali, and at the time, the Canadian government, which was actually quite supportive of Mali's development projects, they had an agreement with my university, the University of Ottawa, to set up a team of analysts, economists. It was with the economics department. And I went to Mali essentially to write a report on the broad policy issues, but it was extremely broad in terms of reference, agriculture, natural resources, policy, monetary policy, etc. But ironically, I arrived in Mali at the time when there was what they called a donors conference, okay? And I went to this donor conference. I was part of the Canadian delegation. I just sat at the back of the room and listened. But the thing is that at that time, it was in the early 80s, they were already imposing these deadly reforms. And that was already constraining any kind of sovereign national project that they could be formulating. And I look back on that and I say, well, that really is the watershed. It's the beginning of a different form of colonialism under the brunt of IMF World Bank reforms, where the IMF and the World Bank come in and they essentially decide what the country should be doing, how it should be spending its money, what sectors it should be supporting, and so on and so forth. And so the whole issue of sovereignty is there. And then I returned subsequently the following year, that was in 1983, and I was on a mission. Again, it was for the Canadian International Development Agency to study the various regions and to come up with an assessment of what was happening, and then also to advise the Canadian government on avenues for development aid. Now, what happened is I went up, I traveled across the desert up to, at the time, there was no road, and it was during the dry season, so literally the riverbed, the Niger riverbed, was dried up. It was in a Toyota Land Cruiser, so we went up the riverbed. We got lost in the desert and ultimately arrived at Timbuktu at something like 2 in the morning. And there I subsequently visited other parts of the country. But I was struck by the fact that this legendary city of Timbuktu was a multi-ethnic crossroads. There was still a lot of trade going on. I met with the Tuaregs. Then I went into neighboring villages and I looked at irrigation projects and so on along the Niger Valley. On the way back from Timbuktu down to Mopti, which is close, in fact, to one of the cities which were until recently held by the Al-Qaeda insurgents, I stopped and I spoke to people there, school teachers and so on, and I was particularly concerned by the fact that there was a very severe drought. And I actually met up with a World Bank mission. There were a mission of 9 people. I was all alone with the driver. And then I spoke to, it was a secondary school teacher. We sat down and he explained to me that this whole region, the food situation was tremendously precarious. Okay. And it still is today, even worse. And he said, we don't have any more food stocks. And if there's not going to be any kind of a shift in rainfall, we can expect the worst. And I talked to farmers, and subsequently I got back to Ottawa and I wrote a 4-page report and I warned.
A 4-page report?
Well, this was an initial report before I actually drafted the big 400-page report. This was a 4-page memorandum, which I submitted to the Canadian International Development Agency. And I said, in substance, I said, if nothing is done, this region will be affected by famine. And I guess a few months later, it happened. That was the great famine of the early 80s, 1983-84.
Was that famine exacerbated by the IMF and World Bank requirements?
Oh, absolutely.
For them to, absolutely. to grow export crops instead of subsistence crops?
Absolutely. Now, let me explain to you what happened to the region. This is a region a little bit south of Timbuktu on the Niger Valley. Essentially what happened is if they run out of food, it's not that the food is not available, it's simply they can't afford it, and then the food stocks that the villagers will build up when they're depleted, well, then they've got no more food. And what happened is that people ran out of food, but they had nowhere to go. They couldn't go further south where there was food, where the climate was less devastating, and they didn't have money to pay for transportation out of that region, because you needed to go either by car, by bus or something, and the distances were still pretty large distances, but it's a big area, and so they were landlocked, literally landlocked in the sense that they didn't have the possibility of leaving that area. And what I had noticed in my study of the agricultural system is that all the resources of water, irrigation, and extension by the Ministry of Agriculture, it all went to the export crops. Cotton was one of the major crops. And they made a distinction between what was called, in French they called it, agriculture encadrée means essentially, encadrée means, it means structured agriculture. Structured agriculture means that it's agriculture which has an infrastructure, which has water, irrigation, support from the government in terms of seeds and farm inputs and so on. And then the other area which lies outside that was called the gray zone. Okay. It was known by the farmers as the gray zone and la zone grise. And then I went to la zone grise because la zone grise was all over the place outside of the areas let's say structured agriculture. Agriculture encadrée, you had the gray zone, and I talked to people in the gray zone, but all those people were relying on rainfall. They didn't have any support. You know, they were cultivating crops for food, but they were obviously in a very precarious situation. And then, of course, the World Bank would come in and they would plow money into the areas of structured agriculture, agriculture encadrée, and which were also supporting the export of cotton, which was the mainstay of Mali's economy. So that was the background. It was the dichotomy that existed within the agricultural system, the food distribution, the fact that at the same time the World Bank was ordering the deregulation of the grain market, which means that you don't allow price controls over essential food staples. And that meant that in areas, in the semi-arid areas of the north, where, you know, where there was little rainfall or where people couldn't produce enough food, well, then they couldn't buy it because the price had just literally gone fly high. And when I submitted my report, the reaction, first of all, at the, well, it was a mission. It was not a full embassy which existed in Bamako. It was called a Bureau d'Ambassade of the Canadian government. Well, the reaction said, well, no, there's plenty of food. They've got plenty of food. You know, when I said there's going to be a famine. And in a sense, he was right. There was plenty of food, but it was all stocked up by, you know, by private merchants and so on. And people didn't have the purchasing power to buy that food. And they couldn't produce it because they were in the gray zone and they didn't have the resources to cultivate, and the irrigation had all gone to certain projects in the Niger Valley, which were geared towards export crops. So I certainly lived through that period and became very much aware of how this country was fragile. I haven't been back to Mali, but I can visualize the regions which are subjected to these devastating economic policies and how they impinge on the structure of government, on socio-ethnic divisions, because Mali is a tremendous melting pot of different groups. And I sense there were divisions, but at the same time, there was a lot of solidarity between the groups. And when you met the Tuaregs right in the middle of the desert coming in, they would always, you know, they'd always greet you and so on. So that kind of background, I think, is very important. Mali went through several major famines, and the early 70s, 1973, was a major famine, which was the object of a lot of discussion and debate among economists and social scientists. But that famine then recurred 10 years later in 83-84. And I've just consulted the World Bank reports on Mali. They don't talk about famine anymore. They talk about food insecurity, okay? Food insecurity. So they acknowledge that there's certain areas, parts of the country in Mali, which are affected by food insecurity, and of course then they send in the World Food Program to give them food or whatever, but in effect the life in this country, in Mali, is very, very fragile. And I think it's in that particular context of a very fragile economy, impoverished, very low standard of living, subjected to years of colonization and subsequent actions by the Bretton Woods institutions, you can see how it is now evolving towards it's not a recolonization because it's already colonized, but it's a new phase of colonization. And as I mentioned, it's also the growing role of the United States, to the detriment of France, to the detriment of France as a major power in West Africa.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, The War on Mali. Who are the major actors? I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. What about the hostage crisis at an Algerian natural gas complex that was seized, it was claimed, in retaliation for the French war in Mali? How does the hostage crisis in Algeria relate to the intervention in Mali, or does it?
Well, it certainly does. This operation was coordinated by Mokhtar Belmokhtar, who's leader of an affiliated al-Qaeda group called the Mass Brigade, or those who sign with blood. And the statement was by Belmokhtar, actually was a kidnapping, it was the taking of hostages, that this was retaliation to the actions of the French forces against al-Qaeda operatives in northern Mali. And in fact, what they had requested was negotiations for the release of the hostages, and those negotiations were never implemented. The Algerian forces came in and started bombing the complex with helicopters and so on. Now, I think what is very important to understand is that al-Qaeda in the Maghreb is in fact very much linked up to the al-Qaeda network. And the leader of this particular operation, Mokhtar Belmokhtar, was actually recruited in the late 80s, early 90s by the CIA to wage the covert war in Afghanistan. This is something which is on record. And the Council on Foreign Relations actually acknowledges that, and I quote, that most of the Akim, al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, major leaders are believed to have trained in Afghanistan during the 79 to 89 war against the Soviets as part of a group of North African volunteers known as the Afghan Arabs that returned to the region and radicalized Islamist movements in the years that followed, unquote. Now, it just so happens that the leader who led this terrorist attack against the BP Statoil Sonatrach Aminas gas field complex was trained in Afghanistan at a time when the CIA and its Pakistani affiliate, the Inter-Services Intelligence, were providing support to the recruitment, training, and arming of terrorist brigades. I'm not suggesting that this necessarily implies or involves a CIA connection, but the history of those organizations is important in analyzing the nature of both U.S. as well as French intervention in that region. The other dimension is that within al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, you also have fighters from the Libya Islamic Fighting Group. In fact, there's a very close relationship between those two groups since 2007, and weapons have come in from the Libyan side through the participation of the Libya Islamic Fighting Group. But we recall, and this is a bitter irony, we recall that the Libya Islamic Fighting Group was actually supported by NATO in the 2011 war on Libya. So that there you have a situation where the Libya Islamic Fighting Group is collaborating with Akim and is involved, possibly involved in a terrorist attack in Algeria. And at the same time, the Libya Islamic Fighting Group is supported by NATO, or was supported by NATO. And we know that Libya Islamic Fighting Group mercenaries are also involved in Syria. Now, another dimension of this is that we know that al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, jihadists who are active not only in Algeria but also in Mali, particularly in northern Mali, not only were they trained by the CIA in Afghanistan, but more recently confirmed by the French newspaper Le Canard Enchaîné in a June 2012 report, Qatar, which is a staunch ally of the United States, has in fact been funding various terrorist entities in Mali, including the Salafist group Ansar Eddine, which works hand in glove with Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. So there you have a situation where covert funding is provided to terrorist organizations from an ally of the United States, and these terrorist organizations are involved in attacks on facilities of British Petroleum involving a hostage crisis and a subsequent intervention by the Algerian forces resulting in deaths which were not, and that the press has confirmed it, were not related to the actual hostage taking in the first place. These were not executions. They were actual casualties from the bombings of the Algerian helicopters.
And isn't it also a fact that this gas complex in Algeria is right on the border with Libya?
Absolutely. The gas complex is located on the Libya-Algeria border, and it is also very close, actually, to the border with Tunisia. But it's very close. It's right slap on the border. And consequently, within the terrorist brigade which attacked the gas complex, it is reported that there were mercenaries from a number of countries, and one suspects that within that group there were members of the Libya Islamic Fighting Group.
Michel, what else do you think that people need to understand about the current situation in Mali with regard to the French intervention? It looks like other countries now, the British, the Americans, are talking about drones, sending drones in. What do you think it's essential for people to understand about the current situation there?
Well, I think we have to essentially connect the dots of different actions waged throughout the African continent and even beyond in the Middle East as well, so that at the same time, if we go back to the 90s, the instability prevailing in Côte d'Ivoire with the displacement of the government also indicates the encroachment by the United States on countries which were within the French sphere of influence. Côte d'Ivoire was a country which had a significant French community with French interests, and ultimately through successive coups and military interventions which have taken place over the years, that country is increasingly within the U.S. sphere of influence, so that these attempts to implement regime change or to topple governments or to finance insurgencies have been occurring in different parts of the continent for the last 20 years. We have to address the issue of Rwanda. We have to address the issue of Somalia. What happened in the Sudan, which was also an insurgency supported by the United States, the secession of Sudan, the creation of southern Sudan, and the wars in the Congo, which have led to 7 million deaths. People don't even know about these wars. They don't know about the wars in the Sudan. They don't know about the wars in the Congo. And the millions of people, literally, who died as a result of these wars. And these wars were portrayed as civil wars. They weren't civil wars. They were insurrections funded by Western powers, particularly United States and Britain. And that was true as far as Rwanda is concerned. It was also true as far as Sudan is concerned. And the Congo as well was a U.S.-supported insurrection. Well, it's a reconquest of Africa, but under a different colonial agenda. It's more of an Anglo-American colonial agenda. The other colonial powers have been shoved out. Now, take Mozambique. Mozambique was a colony of Portugal. Well, It joined the Commonwealth. Now, what historical links does Mozambique, which was a Portuguese-speaking country, have with Britain? None. None whatsoever. They joined the Commonwealth. Rwanda has become a country which now, where English is an official language. The university functions in English. The professors are trained in the United States and Britain. In 2009, they decided to have all the high schools operate only in English. That means all the elites, by definition, will be English-speaking. I think what characterizes the crisis in Mali is that the insurrection, namely Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, is supported covertly by the United States, and at the same time, the United States is waging a war against Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb by bringing in French troops and mobilizing those French troops to attack the same insurgents which they themselves are supporting. And when one comes to the realization that the United States is supporting both sides, one then understands that this is not an internal conflict. It is a war of aggression, which consists in destabilizing a nation state, implementing regime change, and ultimately also establishing an American colony, which previously was under the hegemony of the French Republic. Essentially, what I want to say is that you have several sides of this conflict, and all sides are supported by the same, are supported by the United States, either covertly or overtly. You know, the historical background is important because when you impoverish a country through macroeconomic reform, you set the stage for civil war, essentially. I saw it in Rwanda as well. You send in the IMF and the World Bank, and then you have a civil war, okay? But you trigger the civil war. The same thing happened in Yugoslavia, okay? Successive macroeconomic reforms in the 1980s, creating ethnic tensions, impoverishing people, and then you start funding the insurgencies. So you can find many historical analogies of this. And it's true for many other countries as well.
Michel Chosadovsky, thank you very much.
Delighted to be on the program.
I've been speaking with Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show has been The War on Mali. Who are the major actors? Michel Chosadovsky is director of the Center for Research on Globalization, based in Montreal, Quebec. The global research website, globalresearch.ca, publishes news articles, commentary, background research, and analysis on a broad range of issues. Michel Chosadovsky is the author of The Globalization of Poverty and the New World Order, War and Globalization, The Truth Behind September 11th, and America's War on Terrorism, as well as numerous articles. He is a co-editor and contributor to a new anthology, The Global Economic Crisis, The Great Depression of the 21st Century. Many economists and investigative journalists have contributed to this new volume. Visit the Center for Research on Globalization website at www.globalresearch.ca. That's globalresearch.ca. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner and Yara Mako. To leave comments or order copies of shows, email us at blfaulkner@yahoo.com. That's blfaulkner@yahoo.com. Visit our website at www.gunsandbutter.org. That's gunsandbutter.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, veteran peace activist Kathy Kelly gives a powerful talk on the horrors of the U.S. War on Terror. The horrors experienced by the innocent civilians trapped on the ground. I hope you'll stay tuned. I don't have many heroes. Maybe I don't actually have any, but I can think of a half dozen people who are definitely in the running. Say, Martin Luther King in the last year of his life. Maybe also Noam Chomsky, perhaps Howard Zinn, definitely Kathy Kelly. Kathy Kelly is a radical Catholic peace activist and human rights activist. She is a leader of the organization Voices for Creative Nonviolence. She is just short of 63 years old. For the past several decades, she has spent much of her time living among civilians stuck in war zones, living among the civilians who are on the receiving end of the elective wars launched by the United States. She's been on the ground extensively in Iraq and Afghanistan, and also in Gaza. She tries to make us hear the voices of the ordinary people who bear the brunt of the suffering, and indeed do the brunt of the dying in America's never-ending series of wars of choice. She has twice been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. She's just recently out of prison, again, this time because of a peaceful protest on an Air National Guard base near Syracuse, New York, an air base connected with the U.S. drone warfare program. On October 6, 2015, she came back to Syracuse to speak. 3 days before, a U.S. warplane had destroyed a hospital in Kunduz, Afghanistan, a hospital operated by Doctors Without Borders. This destruction was not a mistake. The Air Force well knew that they were bombing a hospital. They made repeated attacks on the hospital and the hospital only that night, one attack every 15 minutes for an hour and a quarter. 22 doctors, hospital staff workers, and civilian patients were killed in the raid. Many burned alive in their beds. The hospital was totally destroyed. There were no militants in or near the hospital. There was no fighting. There was no Taliban anywhere in the vicinity. We will play Kathy Kelly's talk this week and next. Kelly jokingly describes herself as an ex-con who never pays her taxes, which is true, but perhaps not the whole story. Why don't you have a listen and see how you would describe her? Kathy Kelly.
I do have this idea of how do we unshackle ourselves from these systems of war and imprisonment. And a book that's been, for me, very, very important is written by Jim Loney, his memoir of having been captured in Iraq, and he was held captive for 118 days. But one of the strange things about their captivity was that while they were being held captive, they actually found the key to their own shackles. And so after the guards would leave at night and the room would be dark, they were all shackled together, but they'd pull out the key and unshackle themselves. So they could at least roll over, and then before the guards came back, they shackled themselves up again. And that, to me, has been a very important symbol. Is there some way that we can unshackle ourselves? And Jim struggled with whether or not to really try and make a break for it, like jump out a window and go. But they didn't know where they were, and they didn't know if they might then occasion their own murder. And I can't recommend the book strongly enough, Captivity by James Loney. But I want to go back to that idea of unshackling ourselves. We know that the drones purportedly supplying intelligence, the surveillance drones, about patterns of life in places like Afghanistan are woefully, woefully inadequate. And so I'd like to talk a little bit about some of what I knew from firsthand experience. I hope you'll indulge me in going back to some time that Cynthia Banas and Ed and I and others had spent in Iraq. I have no skills as a nurse, as a technician, in any of the healing arts. I wish that I did, but I don't. But while we were in Baghdad in the 2003 shock and awe bombing, which was shocking and was awful, we were with a Dr. April Hurley, and she could make a difference in the emergency room, and so she would want to go over there, and sometimes she couldn't go unless for some reason the Iraqi government, while they were still in power, said I had to be there too, so I'd feel completely in the way, but would go with April. And you could see how hard it was for the hospital workers to deal with families coming in with their loved ones, the bodies ripped apart, the bones broken, and there was chaos. And somebody had to kind of sort people out and say, you can go this far, but you can't. And people were screaming. And somebody had to come and try to clean up the pools of blood that were happening as people came. I mean, you can't imagine in a war zone how stressful, how difficult these hospital situations are. But I can imagine it a little bit. I remember being in Gaza, and while there were bombs exploding once every 11 minutes overnight, when I went into the Al-Shifa hospital, I remember one of the doctors put his head in his hands were shaking, and he said, all these 22 days, we do not even know what has been used against us. The white phosphorus, the dense inert metal explosions. Just we know that for 22 days, the world watched and nobody came to help us. Mm-hmm. And so I think about the reality of people trying to deliver health care, trying to do it under very, very difficult circumstances. And I want to describe to you something so fraudulent that it almost creates a sort of a sickness. And that's not because I want to make us sick, but I want to help us become honest together about where the United States seems to be moving. Just in these first 6 months of 2015, the United States AID, it's Aid for International Development, has been maintaining, as it has for many years, a presence in Afghanistan. Now, there's a very principled person named John Sopko, who is the Special Inspector General for Afghan Reconstruction. It's called SIGAR. And it's remarkable, this man quarterly delivers to the U.S. Congress a very full and scathing report on the corruption, the fraud, the graft, the inadequacy of many, many, many of the non-governmental organizations and governmental organizations that have been functioning in Afghanistan. And many of his staff are people who previously filed reports for the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction, SIGAR. And they also found corruption and fraud. But one of the things that came out in a July 25th letter from Special Inspector General John Sopko to the head of the Aid for International Development was that of 641 projects for health care delivery in Afghanistan that supposedly USAID was teaming up with the Afghan health ministry to maintain, And of the list of all the coordinates, the geographical coordinates of where those places were within Afghanistan, it turned out that 80% really couldn't be located. Six of the places that the USAID claimed it was funding were located, actually, according to the coordinates, in Tajikistan, a northern country. Six more were located in Pakistan, and one was located in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea. There were 189, which were given as coordinates for hospital projects, and when they used basically Google Earth, they call it geospatial analysis, when 189 of these places were located in Afghanistan, there wasn't a single building within 400 yards of the coordinate, and in some cases within a half mile. So I guess you would call these places ghost hospitals. They don't really exist. And actually, there's a whole nother long list of ghost schools and ghost students and ghost teachers. And people are skimming money, getting paid, making up ghost budgets. And in this case, with the healthcare facilities, apparently somebody is getting the money because the money has already been dispersed by USAID. Now, it's chump change in terms of the Pentagon budget. The Pentagon is spending about $35 billion this year in Afghanistan to maintain 9,800 soldiers. We, again, have something in the vicinity of $2 million per soldier for a year if you were going to divide it up that way. So I realize that the amount I'm thinking of in this case, $234 million, does not seem to be such a huge sum in terms of the big budget. But it's the principle, I suppose, that would bother me anyway. And I knew that in 2011, the same pattern had happened. USAID was clearly laid out, called on the carpet. The Congress knows. It's all presented to the Congress people. Nothing happens in terms of an investigation or a conclusion. Well, you probably can see where this is going. A ghost hospital. An extremely reputable group, Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, had in very difficult circumstances built a hospital compound the size of a football field. And then there was one building that's the actual hospital. It's not the living quarters. It's not the mess hall. It's the actual hospital. And anticipating that there would be fighting and it could escalate, they had sent very carefully the exact coordinates for their very real hospital in the week leading up to this tragic, terrible attack of the United States on that hospital. 354 people had been treated for wounds, many of them, in the hospital because of the fighting. The doctors and the nurses didn't run away. They were incredibly brave, and 59 of those people were children. And in that hospital building, there were doctors and nurses who weekly had been notifying the United States military, the Afghan military, and the United Nations exactly what their geographical coordinates were, so that if there was fighting, in the event that there was aerial bombardment, it would be clear this place is a hospital. And the week of October 3rd, those coordinates had been called in one more time. So I state that because there was no doubt, it's patently obvious, that to engage in aerial bombardment of that particular spot was something that was done with prior knowledge that it was a hospital. Or maybe even if somehow the communication hadn't gone through. Once the first bomb hit the intensive care unit, a nurse who survived said she could not find words to describe the horror of the patients burning in their own beds. Once the first bomb hit at 2:05 in the morning, frantic workers notified their organizations. The organizations told the United States military, "You're bombing a hospital," and the bombing continued in 15-minute intervals until 3:15 in the morning. And the hospital is in rubble, and there are windows which had flames blazing out of them. And there were 22 people killed, and at least 12 of them were medical staff, and three of them were children. And now, I suppose you could say, it's a ghost hospital. And what of all the people who live in that region? The closest clinic is in a place called Pulei Chumri, and it's more of a, you know, extended village. Kunduz was the fifth largest city in Afghanistan. And where are people going to go for maternal care, for infant care, for pediatric care? Where are they going to go if the fighting continues to rage? And those that were brought to Kabul, and that must have been a very arduous journey, were brought to hospitals where the census was already filled. And Kabul is a place of great violence right now. My young friend said last night, they were up all night long, a 10-hour gun battle with explosions, and they weren't sure that they'd make it through the night. Is there no mercy on the part of the people that are in our Congress that get these quadrennial reports, that understand surely that when the head of the Doctors Without Borders insists that there must be an independent international investigation of what happened that cannot include any of the parties to this act? And the United States military says, well, it will be under investigation. July 19th, the United States helicopters attacked an Afghan military outpost, and they killed 10 people. And then the United States military said, well, we'll investigate. And I tried hard all day yesterday to see if I could find some thread, some word about that investigation, not a word. And so it's not acceptable to say that the United States will investigate, the United States military will investigate. I believe right now, as Amnesty International, the United Nations assistance mission in Afghanistan, UNICEF, certainly Doctors Without Borders, the Emergency Surgical Centers for Victims of War, all of these people are raising a very insistent, almost like the wagons are circling round, demand that there be an end to the attacks of the United States aerial bombing on places that are meant to be enabling care for people. There has to be a public outcry as well. Yes. And that's our work. So one thing Voices has thought of is that maybe people could go to healthcare facilities here in our own locales. In Chicago today, they went to Stroger Hospital and they asked doctors just to take a little bit of time and come out in the white coats and stethoscopes and join with people with a sign like the one that's here. To bomb this place would be a war crime. The same is true in Afghanistan. I think the United States has been banking on people in the United States kind of forgetting about Afghanistan. And we know how important literacy is. We care a lot about literacy in our country. We need another kind of literacy. We need to embark on extending another kind of literacy, becoming literate in the stories of the consequences of people who can't run away from our wars. There's some stories that I find I can't really return to myself. And I know others of you will understand this. If you've experienced traumas, you just kind of need to let that story rest until it is the right time to go back to it. And so I just like to offer you one of those stories. It's actually from 2 years ago in my own life, but it's something I think I can perhaps behold a little better now in my life. I was home alone in Kabul at what we call the Border Free Center. My young friends have got quite a thriving center going right now, and it's the place where the big heavy woolen blankets, we call them the duvets, are organized, the project to make these duvets is organized there. And it's also a place where little child laborers come in and they become literate because the kids have organized a street kids school, and these blue scarves are made there, and it's a really wonderful place to be. But I happen to be the only one there because youngsters were either in school or going up the mountainsides to visit widows and try to figure out who might be the ones who would actually be making these duvets, 20 Tajik women, 20 Pashto women, 20 Hazara women, to make it inter-ethnic and draw women from the different tribes. And the women then stuff the wool into coverlets, sew them up, and then these big, heavy blankets are given away for free because of the generosity of people in the United States and the UK and Australia, really. And the women are all paid a living wage. So it's been a wonderful project. Others were out visiting the families of the street kids, because every family is given a big sack of rice and a big container of cooking oil. And the deal is, let your child kind of retire from being a vendor on the streets and begin to become literate, begin to study math, study these courses in nonviolence, and we'll compensate for what the kids would have earned on the streets. And so again, through generosity of people outside of Afghanistan, the Afghan peace volunteers have been able to organize this for 100 kids. So they're often out and about. And I heard a racket at the gate, and I realized, no, I better go down. It might be one of the kids. And I opened the door, and in immediately came two women, and my heart sank, because I was pretty sure I knew why they had come. And sure enough, they had walked a long, long way from Barchi. They had probably walked about 3.5 hours, and they were tired, and they were thirsty and hungry, no doubt. And they wanted to be part of the women who would be on the list to make those heavy blankets. But I knew the list had already been formed. And you can't have an endless number of people who will, we just don't have the wherewithal. And I certainly am not the one to make that call anyway. And so I was trying to use what diary I have and be polite. And the older woman, a kind of grandmotherly, maybe about my age, really, she began to thump her breast, and she started to cry. And the younger woman lifted up the older woman's skirt to show me a festering wound on her ankle. And they talked about how they could only feed their children stale bread and tea. And I've heard this so many times, and the statistics bear it out now. There's a rise in severe acute malnourishment in Afghanistan, a rise in food insecurity, a lack of clean water, no health care. And I was trying to say that, you know, there really wasn't something I could do. And so the women did something that I do understand. They sat down. And the older woman took my hand and stroked it and begged me to help. And well, then Sonia came back, and Sonia was the keeper of the list, and Sonia would have to tell the two women, as she would have to tell many, many, many more women, I'm sorry, I'm so very sorry, but we can't help you this year. And then ever so gently and politely, she escorted them back through the gate, and then I saw Sonia go off around a corner, and she came back, and her eyes were red. My friend Hakim, the medical doctor from Singapore, and I call these women with deepest respect the women who won't go away. They're doing what they should do, what they must do. And I think maybe one of the only groups that matches their tenacity and their resolve are the United States generals. That won't go away. They won't go away. And so they try to scare us. You know, if you don't support this, you won't have jobs in your community. As though we're not able to ask what kinds of work are appropriate and valid to do. Part of our literacy, part of our education must become increasingly asking that question. Is it valid work? Is it ever valid to teach another person in any form to kill, to rip apart, to shred another human being? Is it ever valid to pay people, to employ people, to keep other people separated from their loved ones for years and years and maybe even decades? So what kind of work is appropriate in a time when we so need people to be retrofitting the housing stock and helping us deal with climate change and building mass transit systems and taking care of our elderly people and starting Head Start programs for the children? All of the people could be given meaningful, good work to do. And then they try to scare us. You know, if you don't bankroll everything that the so-called Defense Department wants, then ISIS will be a threat to you. But I think back to those hospital scenes, and I think back to 8-year-old Dima in the Alphanar Hotel who befriended Ed and Cynthia and me. And I think back to that little girl looking up apologetically at her father because she was standing in a pool of her own urine. She was so frightened by the bombing. And I remember his face, a look of disgust and anger and fear. And I think of sitting in a hospital ward with little babies that would never leave that ward. The economic sanctions were punishing them to death. And my friend Martin Thomas, a nurse from the United Kingdom, looking at the other mothers with the babies in their arms and murmuring, "I think I understand. It's a death row for infants, isn't it? A death row for infants." And I think about going to the Buka compound after the Shock and Awe bombing. Three young teenagers had come, and they whispered. They were so ashamed of their own memory. They whispered to me, "We were in the Buka camp." And they paraded us naked in front of the women's U.S. soldiers. And we had to beg for our food and sometimes bark like dogs or say, "I love George Bush." And sometimes we were so cold we tried to dig a hole in the sand because at the time it was a tent, primitive tent, prison encampment. And they tried to warm up by burrowing in the sand, and they were afraid of desert snakes and desert scorpions. And when I had a chance to go into the camp and visit some of the friends they'd left behind, those friends told the same story, so I believe that they were all telling the truth. But there's another truth, and that's that the so-called caliph, the so-called head of ISIS, Ali Baghdadi, spent 5 years in that prison. And it was from that prison that he recruited some of the people that became his main aide-de-camp people, if you will, for ISIS. So, yes, if somebody goes from London or goes from Chechnya or goes from the United States and joins ISIS, I find that difficult to understand. But I also find it difficult to understand why somebody from the United States would enroll in an armed force and go clear across the world to another country where they don't speak the language and they don't know the culture and be willing to sometimes torture and sometimes kill. But when it's a matter of people who've lived in Iraq, and they've gone through the 1991 war. I was there during that war, and it was a brutal destruction of their infrastructure. They've gone through the economic sanctions. They've gone through Shock and Awe. They've gone through civil war. They've gone through Abu Ghraib. They've gone through the callous ways that the United States and foreign occupations have treated them. Do we think that if we again bomb and torture and kill this population, there won't be the rise of an even more extremist, a more fundamentalist group than ISIS today? War is not the answer. Abolishing war would be the way for a decent future. And my young friends in Afghanistan, they know it. They know it so well that today, even though they were frightened to death last night, they're organizing themselves to help the families that have sought refuge from Kunduz. These are the young people who could lead us toward a better future. And many of the women I met in prison are the people who could lead us toward a better future. And our determination together to say we will unshackle ourselves from these systems of war and prison with every bit of ingenuity and energy and finding courage from one another, collective determination.
Peace activist Kathy Kelly speaking in Syracuse, New York on October 6, 2015. I have snipped a few minutes from the beginning of her talk to make it fit. Kelly's talk was recorded on video by Wilton Vaught. Many thanks for that. You can find more of Vaught's good public affairs videos on his website, which is othervoicesotherchoices.blogspot.com. Yes, Wilton and I are neighbors on the Blogspot server. Of course, we are to be found at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Next week, Kathy Kelly tells more powerful stories in her talk's question and answer session. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, suggesting illegitimi non carborundum, war is not healthy for children and other living things, and please come back again next week. Ciao.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. The show you're about to hear was originally aired in January of 2015. On previous shows, I've explored the issues around the 28 redacted pages from the Joint Congressional Inquiry into 9/11. This was released in December of 2002. I've also looked at the two co-chairs of that inquiry, Senator Bob Graham and Congressman Porter Goss. Senator Bob Graham from Florida has been pushing from very early on to declassify the 28 redacted pages from this inquiry, and there's a new movement in Congress to declassify these pages. It's led by Congressman Walter Jones from North Carolina and Stephen Lynch from Massachusetts, and Congressman Tom Massey is also involved in it. On Friday, January 9th, at the same time the terrorist attacks in France were playing out, they held a press conference to discuss these 28 redacted pages and the bill they hope to introduce in the new 114th Congress to declassify these 28 pages. The number of the bill hasn't been designated yet. The old version in the last Congress was H.R. 428. So they held this press conference in Washington, D.C., and I'm going to share with you today some clips from that event. After listening to it, I'm more convinced than ever that it's an attempt to keep the official narrative in place and blame the Saudis for their financial support of the alleged 19 hijackers, while avoiding any look at U.S. or other countries' involvement in 9/11, of which there's ample evidence. But you can listen to this and see what you think. So here's Senator Bob Graham's speech from this press conference on January 9th concerning these 28 redacted pages.
Thank you very much. And I, too, want to thank Walter and Steve, Congressman Jones and Lynch, for their leadership in bringing this matter to the attention of the Congress. I want to thank the family members who have been, without question, the most influential force in all of the changes that have occurred as a result of 9/11 and will be the most significant force in terms of convincing the president that it is time to give the American people the truth. Needless to say, my remarks that I will espouse this morning are considerably different than they would have been but for events in Paris this morning, which in my judgment bring this matter into its proper focus. But first, a little background. After 9/11, it was clear that the Congress was going to be called upon to conduct some form of an inquiry as to what happened. The decision by the leadership was to combine the intelligence committees of the House and the Senate into a single body for the first time in the history of the Congress that had occurred for purposes of carrying out this inquiry. The inquiry took the year of 2002. It included interviewing hundreds of witnesses, tens of thousands of pages of documentation leading up to an over 800-page report, which was submitted in December of 2002. Some 6 months later, the declassified version emerged, and we were shocked to see that an important chapter in the report had not been redacted. That is, as Congressman Lynch and Congressman Jones said, a word or a phrase here or there, but an entire chapter. Since that chapter continues to be classified, none of us can talk about it in public. But I think it's fair to say that it is a central chapter in terms of understanding who was the support network that allowed 9/11 to occur. When we saw that this chapter had been eliminated, there was an immediate outcry. Senator Dick Shelby, Republican from Alabama, who had been the chair and was at that time the vice chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, and I issued a statement to the effect that we were intimately familiar with that chapter. We considered it to have no adverse effect on national security, that it was important to the overall understanding of 9/11, and it should be released. We have subsequently been joined in that by others who were involved, including the chairman of the House Committee, Porter Goss, who wishes that he could have been here today to participate as well. And subsequently, the Citizen 9/11 Commission's two co-chairs, Lee Hamilton and Tom Kane, have also advocated that these 28 pages be released. Shortly after the declassification process ended, a letter was prepared, signed by almost half of the membership of the United States Senate, bipartisan, including Senator Joe Biden of Delaware, Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts, and Senator Clinton of New York, all calling upon President Bush to release the 28 pages. What have been the consequences of this refusal to release the pages? And let me say, while the 28 pages are maybe the most important and the most prominent, they are by no means the only example of where information that is important to understanding the full extent of 9/11 have also been withheld from the American people. So the comments I'm going to make are specifically about the 28 pages, but more generally about a pattern of cover-up that for 12 years has kept the American people from a full understanding of the most horrific attack against the United States in its history. The consequences, in my judgment, are three. One is a denial of the truth. A core question in 9/11 is, did these 19 people act alone, or did they have a network of support which facilitated their ability to carry out a very complex plot? No one who has looked closely at the facts, including the individuals that I just named, have come to a conclusion other than that it is highly improbable that the 19 people could have acted alone. Yet the official position of the United States government has been that they did act alone and that there is no necessity for further inquiry into the question of whether there was a support network. We're now in the 150th anniversary of the American Civil War, and we've had a national history classroom over the past few years as incidents that were consistent with a date in the current era coincided with a date during that war. One of the pieces of information that we have learned, at least I have learned, is that President Lincoln had a policy throughout the war that every message that came into the government, specifically into the State Department, was a matter of public record on a daily basis. His feeling was that if the support of the American people were going to be maintained in a war, which was increasingly bloody, many loss of lives and loss of treasure, that it took the confidence of the American people that their government was conducting itself in an appropriate manner and that the key to that confidence was disclosure. I wish we applied the Lincoln-esque standard to what happened in 9/11. The second issue is the issue of justice. Some 3,000 members of the families who were lost on 9/11 have been trying for years to get justice through our system for the losses that they have suffered. The position of the United States government has been to protect Saudi Arabia. At virtually every step of the judicial process, when the United States government was called upon to take a position, it has been a position adverse to the interests of United States citizens seeking justice and protective of the government, which, in my judgment, was the most responsible for that network of support. Again, an example from the Civil War. The British had signed a neutrality agreement with the United States that they would not be involved in the Civil War. It was found out subsequently that, in fact, their shipyards had been building military vessels for the Confederacy. After the war ended, the United States didn't forget. It did not walk away from the negative effects of Britain's perfidy. Rather, it pursued it and finally secured recognition of what the British had done and some compensation for the consequences of their action. What a difference between the way this country saw itself as a proudful defender of justice for its citizens and what we are experiencing today. The third consequence is the issue of national security. And frequently those who have defended non-disclosure have said, this cannot be made available to the American people because it will be adverse to our national security. It will affect methods and sources of information or other information that is inappropriate to be made publicly known. As the two congressmen have just said, they both read the report, not 12 years ago as I participated in writing the report, but they have read it recently and have both come to the same conclusion that we did a dozen years ago, that there is no threat to national security in disclosure. I'm going to make the case today that there's a threat to national security by non-disclosure, and we saw another chapter of that today in Paris. Here are some facts. The Saudis know what they did. They are not persons who are unaware of the consequences of their government's action. Second, the Saudis know that we know what they did. Somebody in the federal government has read these 28 pages. Someone in the federal government has read all the other documents that have been covered up so far. And the Saudis know that. What would you think the Saudis' position would be if they knew what they had done, they knew what the United States knew what they had done, and they also observed that the United States had taken a position of either passivity or actual hostility to letting those facts be known? What would the Saudi government do in that circumstance, which is precisely where they have been for more than a decade? Well, one, they have continued, maybe accelerated, their support for one of the most extreme forms of Islam, Wahhabism, throughout the world, particularly in the Middle East. And second, they have supported their religious fervor with financial and other forms of support of the institutions which were going to carry out those extreme forms of Islam. Those institutions have included mosques, madrasas, and military. Al-Qaeda was a creature of Saudi Arabia. The regional groups such as Al-Shabaab have been largely creatures of Saudi Arabia. And now ISIS is the latest creature. Yes, I hope and I trust that the United States will crush ISIS. But if we think that is the definition of victory, we are being very naive. ISIS is a consequence, not a cause. It is a consequence of the spread of extremism, largely by Saudi Arabia. And if it is crushed, there will be another institution established, financed, supported to carry on the cause. So the consequences of our passivity to Saudi Arabia have been that we have tolerated this succession of institutions, violent, extremely hurtful to the region of the Middle East, and a threat to the world, as we saw this morning in Paris. So I conclude by saying this is a very important issue. It may seem stale to some, but it is as current as the headlines that we will read today. It is an issue that goes to the core of the United States contract with its people, that the people would give the government the credibility and support to govern. The government would give the people the information upon which they can make good judgments as to the appropriateness of governmental action. It's as fundamental as justice to our people who have suffered so by this evil union of extremism and a very powerful nation state. And it is the security of the people of the United States of America. So I again thank the congressmen for their leadership. I hope that they will soon be joined by a rising tide of other members of Congress who recognize the importance of this issue. And then finally, that the President of the United States will declare that he is going to adopt the Lincoln-esque standard of full disclosure and rely on the intelligence and judgment and patriotism of the American people to decide what the appropriate course of action should be. Thank you.
So that was Senator Bob Graham of Florida talking about the need to release the 28 redacted pages of the Joint Congressional Inquiry into 9/11 that was released in December of 2002. I do agree with him that there's a cover-up going on, and also that it was highly improbable that the 19 alleged hijackers could have been able to act alone to pull off 9/11. Of course, I don't think they were involved at all, except for as patsies, and then only some of them, because we know that many of them are still alive after 9/11. And I agree that our government should follow the Lincoln-esque standards of full transparency that he talked about. And I agree that our government doesn't appear to be concerned for its own citizens, and instead it seems like it's covering up and protecting other countries, and not just Saudi Arabia in my mind. And I think it's also protecting and supporting and creating the alleged terrorists. And it doesn't do this alone. Of course, it does it with the support of these other countries in the Middle East. Now, and I'm no big fan of Saudi Arabia. I mean, at least the royal family, the government, the Saudi people, I'm sure are probably pretty nice, just like most people around the world. So when he says that Al-Qaeda was the creature of Saudi Arabia, I'd like to remind him that it was the CIA that created Al-Qaeda in the 1980s to confront the Russians in Afghanistan. And all the evidence shows that we never lost those ties. So there's ample evidence that the U.S. and its allies in the Middle East were involved in the creation of ISIS and in its continuing support. This is not new behavior. Just look up Operation Gladio and the terrorist attacks in Europe in the 1960s and 70s. The press conference was attended by a few 9/11 victims' family members and members of the press and the public. Here's one question that I wanted to share with you.
Carl Golub at jfkvigil.com. I'm a retired U.S. Customs agent. In the fall of 2001, myself and many other agents were assigned to Fresh Kittles Landfill, where the rubble of World Trade Center 7 was brought, and we were tasked with sifting through WTC-7, the 47-story third tower that collapsed that day, and calling out computer components that other agencies didn't want left in the landfill. And I can just testify from my experience as an investigator that those three towers were not brought down solely by two airplanes and their jet fuel, that there is abundant evidence of controlled demolition of those three towers. And my question is whether these 28 pages will point at all towards that reality and the potential of true false flag terrorism in this event.
My answer is no.
That's it. The 28 pages does not deal with that issue at all.
And here's another question and answer that I wanted to share with you. In this case, the congressman's response reveals a really optimistic view of our corporate media and their ability to do their job.
Jack Larson, I am thebasictruth.com. My question is, I heard before that there is multiple foreign governments that could be actually implicated in the pages. Is it just totally Saudi Arabia, or is there other active governments that could be involved?
I personally think that the report speaks for itself. And there's one thing that needs to be said here. Once these 28 pages are released, The press will do their job. We've got some smart folks out there on the part of the press. They will investigate this, and there'll be a collective debate and discussion about the implications of these 28 pages. And your question and others will be answered. That's the whole process here. We'll do a deep dive on this collectively with the full focus of transparency that it deserves. And I think there will be, you know, I'll learn from the debate. Even though I've read the 28 pages, I'm sure there'll be other sets of eyes that will look at that same 28 pages and come up with things that I did not immediately recognize. So, you know, I think all of this is an important understanding process, and that transparency from all these different angles will really enlighten our understanding of this whole terrible and tragic event.
So think about that for a minute. Why is it okay to reveal the Saudi involvement identified in these 28 redacted and classified pages, but not okay to reveal if other countries were also involved? That has me scratching my head. I just can't quite figure that out. The full press conference lasted about 55 minutes. To see and hear the full video of the event, you can go to YouTube, and once on the site, search for 28 redacted pages, press conference, Bob Graham, and you should come to it. And now I want to share with you an article that appeared in the New York Times on January 4th, 2015, called "Conspiracy Theorists Have Suspicious and Sometimes Paranoid Natures." And it's by Cass Sunstein. And I don't know exactly why, but I find this guy somewhat amusing. Anyway, here's how the New York Times describes him. Cass R. Sunstein, the Robert Walmsley University professor at Harvard Law School, is a former administrator of the White House Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs and is the author of Conspiracy Theories and Other Dangerous Ideas, and most recently, Wiser, co-authored with Reed Hasty. And now here's the article. We'll see if you find it as amusing as I do. And here goes. A lot of conspiracy theorists are neither ignorant nor ill-educated. On the contrary, they can be spectacularly well-informed, at least on the topics that interest them. Try arguing with one. They probably know a lot more than you do. Why, then, do they accept theories that are patently inconsistent with reality? One reason involves their suspicious and, in some cases, paranoid natures. Want to know whether your neighbors will accept a particular conspiracy theory? Just ask them what they think about other conspiracy theories. Those who insist that the Apollo moon landings were faked are more likely to believe that the United States caused the 9/11 attacks. Horrible events can make people who are scared and angry look for someone to blame. In fact, people who embrace one conspiracy theory are also inclined to embrace another conspiracy theory that cannot simultaneously be true. In one study, people who said they believed that Osama bin Laden is alive and well were more likely to believe that he was dead before U.S. forces invaded his compound. The belief in a more central idea that authorities are engaged in deceptive cover-ups supports any number of skeptical theories, even leading suspicious individuals to disregard contradictions between them. But conspiracy theories are not only a product of people's natures. Social conditions matter. Horrible events, economic collapse, an assassination, a grievous loss of some kind can make people who are scared and angry look for someone to blame, not least to assert a kind of mastery of the circumstances. The human mind is drawn to think that whenever something bad has happened, it's because someone bad wanted it to happen. Conspiracy theories are especially likely to spread within isolated communities and social networks, including those online. Most people do not know the causes of horrible events, and so we tend to rely on those we trust. If a few people within a network, call them conspiracy entrepreneurs, point to an alleged conspiracy, others within that network might well follow them. After a while, people can become committed to that belief and treat official denials as yet additional evidence of conspiracy, leading to the conspiracist's triumphant question, why would they deny it if it weren't true? And that's the end of the article. As many of you may already know, when Cass Sunstein worked for the Obama administration, He discussed cognitively infiltrating the 9/11 truth movement. David Ray Griffin wrote a book in response to this and called it Cognitive Infiltration. It's a short, clever, and I thought humorous read. If you haven't already read it, I would recommend it. And again, it's called Cognitive Infiltration by David Ray Griffin. It's interesting to me that Cass Sunstein's article came out the same week that the Boston Marathon bombing trial began and that the Paris shootings occurred and a press conference was held on the 28 redacted pages and openly talked about the Saudi involvement in 9/11, even though it's classified, but wouldn't reveal anything else because, well, it's classified information. What a way to kick off the new year. But I'm probably just being paranoid. So let's take a closer look at Cass Sunstein's article. First, I have to say that I don't consider myself a conspiracy theorist. The term is used to discredit anyone who challenges the official account of, in this case, 9/11. It's a total propaganda term. So having said that, back to Sunstein's article, he's a smart guy. I mean, he's been at Harvard Law School. So his title, Conspiracy Theorists Have Suspicious and Sometimes Paranoid Natures, is curious to me because surely he gets that the official account of 9/11 is a conspiracy theory. So is he saying that the government is suspicious and sometimes has a paranoid nature? Or did he just choose to ignore the fact that the official account of 9/11 is a conspiracy theory? Well, that question aside, in the first paragraph, he states that, quote, conspiracy theorists can be spectacularly well-informed. They probably know a lot more than you do, he says. Of course, here he assumes that all of the readers don't question the government on 9/11 or any other issue. And then he asks why, if the conspiracy theorists are so well-informed, he says we even know more than he does on, say, 9/11, why do we hold theories that are inconsistent with reality? And I was just wondering, did it ever occur to him, again, he's a smart guy, that if we know more than he does on the subject, that maybe he's the one with the beliefs that are not consistent with reality? Well, that was just a thought I had. Also, I believed the official account of 9/11 for about the first year. So apparently, I was not suspicious and did not have a paranoid nature. But once the evidence convinced me that I was being lied to about 9/11, and I started to question the government account, did I suddenly become suspicious and paranoid? I mean, how does that work? There's a lot more that I could pick at in this article, but for the sake of time, I'll just do one more. He states that people who believe in, quote, conspiracy theories tend to believe in other, quote, conspiracies as well. And I have to say that he's probably onto something here, but not for the same reasons that he thinks. Because once you learn about how, for example, you've been lied to about 9/11 and about other false flag events and about some of the similarities, you can see the same patterns happening in other events. For example, the omissions and distortions of the corporate media. And that brings me to the recent shootings in France. I watched a mainstream TV news show with a very popular news guy cover the alleged shooting of the police officer in Paris by the alleged terrorists before they fled in the getaway car. They showed only part of the video, so you could see the gunman head toward the policeman, ready to fire, and you could see the cop lying on the ground. The gunman's ready to shoot at him on the sidewalk, and then the news guy says, "We're not going to show you the next part because it's too gruesome," and so they cut back to the guys running away in their getaway car. Later, I saw the full video of this same scene online, and it turns out the gunman shoots at the sidewalk past the police officer, doesn't actually hit the police officer, so there was no blood, no gruesome scene that the corporate media had to censor. What they had to censor was the fact that the gunman didn't actually hit the cop. Now, why they have to censor that is another question. But you see this lie, this cover-up, of the real evidence, or lack of it, by the corporate media, and any thinking person has to begin to question what we're being told. I've seen the corporate media omit and distort the news many times over since 2001, but it still always shocks me just how complicit they are in disseminating the government propaganda. If you want to learn more about the inconsistencies of what we're being told about the Paris shootings, the website globalresearch.ca has lots of articles by many researchers and journalists. And again, it's globalresearch.ca. But be careful. If you learn more about the Paris shootings than Cass Sunstein knows, you could be considered a conspiracy theorist and therefore suspicious and paranoid. And I was just wondering, is this effort to declassify the 28 pages, which blames the Saudis while not questioning any other aspect of the bogus official conspiracy theory of 9/11, the work of Cass Sunstein and his plan for cognitive infiltration? Just a thought. 9/11 Wake Up Call is produced at the University of Hartford, WWUH 91.3 FM, and airs Wednesdays at noon and again at 8 p.m. It also airs on WESU at Wesleyan University in Middletown on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. And the shows are archived at radioforall.net. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. The fabrication of a saint. Native peoples horrified over canonization of Junipero Serra, whom they say is responsible for genocide. And with us is Dr. Christine Grabowski. She's an anthropologist and the principal of Grabowski and Associates, a consulting firm that focuses exclusively on issues of concern to Indian country. She provides anthropological, historical, and genealogical research and analysis on diverse issues, for example, land into trust applications, governance, and tribal membership, as well as federal acknowledgement. Well, let's begin by the fabrication of a saint. There has been a great deal of consternation coming, if you will, from Indian country at the sanctification of Junipero Serra. Tell us what the problem is and why it has evoked the ire of the indigenous population.
Well, the Catholic Church has canonized Junipero Serra, and for people who don't know too much about the history of California, Serra was a missionary who was brought in 1769 to establish missions in what was then called Alta California, which is above what today is the border between Mexico and the United States. And the system that he installed there as Padre Presidente, the father president of the missions, was in fact extremely brutal and oppressive for the Indians. And the native community is, especially the ones who descend from the 21 missions that were in operation during the mission period from 1769 to 1833, when they were abolished by the Mexican independent government. They're pretty horrified that you would that the Pope, he's done all of these progressive, has done many progressive acts regarding peoples in different places, and yet, you know, seems to have turned a blind eye when it comes to California regarding the church's own hand at what resulted in more than 150,000 deaths of Indians while confined at the missions. So, in essence, they're horrified that someone would be elevated to sainthood who is responsible for such death, suffering, destruction of culture, of people, of lands, etc. I mean, it's just truly horrific. And I will say that my practice, I do work all over the country, and I do have clients in California. And I have worked with the mission document, so I know personally baptismal records, death, marriage records. Sometimes the case requires my going back to the 1700s or early 1800s to investigate these issues. And so I was, as a researcher, knew of the horrific story at the missions. I mean, they're viewed as tourist attractions in California, pretty white buildings with red tile roofs. And we, of course, we have even a furniture called after the mission period furniture, and virtually every shopping center in California is in the quote-unquote mission style, but they were forced labor camps. So I myself was pretty horrified when I heard that the Pope, Pope Francis of all people, would be canonizing Sarah. I said, how can this be? How can this be? So that's the origin. If you'd like, I can say something, give a brief history of the missions themselves.
No, I think it's imperative that you do.
Okay. The missions, the history of the missions actually start a couple of hundred years before they actually get started and established. And they start with something called the Papal Bulls, which a lot of people don't know about, but they should. In essence, they were edicts from the Pope, one in 1452 and another one in 1493, the year after Columbus. And they, in essence, those bulls gave the moral and legal authority to Christian sovereigns to go out and, this is a quote, to capture, vanquish, and subdue the Saracens, pagans, and other enemies of Christ, and put them into perpetual slavery, and to take all of their possessions and their property. This was the driving force of all colonialism that took place from the Christian nations of Europe, in the Americas, in Asia, in Africa, you know, Far East. That was the driving force. And what's really important about that, those papal bulls, is that in essence they denied the non-Christians any humanity. They weren't people. You could do whatever you want to them. You could take their land. You could kill them. You could take their property. They weren't eligible for, they weren't deserving of any respect because they were non-Christian. Right? Only because they were non-Christians. And that's pretty heavy stuff. And that's the reason why the Spanish come, that's why the English come, that's why the French come, including the Dutch, why they all come to the Americas. With this driving force, it occurs actually in the 1500s. So let's scroll forward to the 1700s. Spain is already in America, in New Spain. And by the way, there's a really good book about this by Stephen Newcomb called Pagans in the Promised Land. And he also has a film that just came out on it about this doctrine of discovery. But anyway, so you have Spain in New Spain, centered in Mexico, what today is Mexico. And it's trying to defend its territory because although they can go off and take the land of non-Christians with impunity, they have to jockey and with the other European nations. So to the east, they have the French in Louisiana, and they don't want the French coming over and claiming parts of New Spain. So they establish some missions in what today is Texas, specifically because they didn't have people to go and establish settlements. But they said, well, we'll go out, we'll convert some of the Indians, we'll make them into Spanish citizens, they'll have towns, and that will be, in essence, our stake in the soil, because obviously you need something more than a flag saying it's ours. You need people on the ground to make it yours. And that's what they did in Texas. And they also went the other way west. And in the 1700s, the Spanish were afraid of the Russians who were up north in fur trade, and they were going to come south down from what today is Washington State, Oregon in Northern California. So the driving force was to establish missions in what was then called Alta California. What's really important is that now Sarah is charged with going and establishing missions, and he goes there with accompanied by military in 1769. The year before that occurs, there were Jesuit missionaries in Baja California, the Baja Peninsula, and they were kicked out, yanked back to Spain, because the Spanish crown thought that they were enriching themselves at the expense of the Spanish crown. And so they were yanked back, and Franciscans and Dominicans were replaced with them. And what's very important about this part of the story is that Franciscans and Dominicans were given significantly less power because the Spanish crown didn't want them to repeat what the Jesuits had done. And that's a very important part of the story vis-a-vis Sarah, because from the very beginning, he chafes by not having enough power over the missionary enterprise, if you will. So in 1769, Sarah, along with this military commander and a bunch of soldiers, sail up the coast of California. And at first, the Indians are very welcoming. They're curious. They help them. They give them food, et cetera. But he goes there with soldiers. They're not settlements. They're not women and children. They're just Spanish soldiers. And the Spanish soldiers do dastardly deeds to the Indians, including lassoing them, raping the women, and then killing the men when they try to defend their women folk. That really put a kibosh on the missionary attraction. So Sarah, understandably, wasn't too happy about that. He's trying to encourage people to come in, and it's the military, aren't acting very welcoming, if you will. So there is some friction between the two. But Sarah's missionary system in California is very different than anywhere else. And this is where the Catholic Church has said, oh, Sarah, he was a man of his time. He was doing, in essence, implying that what he was doing was repeated anywhere else where there was missionization. And that's simply not true. In Texas, the missions were established. The men who came from Mexico came with their families. They had wives, which was, in essence, a civilizing influence upon them. The Indians, when they came to the missions, they lived in family units. And from the very beginning, that was not Sarah's plan. Sarah's plan was, once you came in, you weren't leaving. It was involuntary confinement at the missions, literally locked in mission compounds. The men were separated from the women. The women were locked in these dormitories, fetid, airless dormitories, where they were then abused by the soldiers who had the keys, who were supposedly looking over them. They couldn't leave. They had to work for the missions, for the clergy and for the soldiers. They didn't own anything that they produced. All of it went to the soldiers and the missionaries, and then only what they deemed appropriate would they give back. And at first, the missions were not self-supporting, because the missionaries and the soldiers really didn't know about California land, et cetera, and how to use it. So the agriculture that they embarked on wasn't successful, and there was literally a great deal of starvation. Now, since the Indians were at the bottom of the rung, they couldn't eat unless the fathers gave them something. They literally were starved. And when they ran away, or attempted to run away, they would literally be beaten and shackled. And there are accounts in the records of the Spanish kept records of this and say, well, why did you run away? Well, it's because my my wife, my son, they all died of starvation. And when I cried, they whipped me. That's why they ran away. And this kind of account is repeated over and over again. And I can tell you that when I was working with the records at one of the missions, I was pretty chilled by the fact that when you look at these baptismal records, you see that a woman gave birth to 7 kids over a few years, and every one of them died. And it's just like, you know, I'm a mother. I can't imagine every one of my children dying. And when Mexican women came, when Spanish women came, they gave birth, their children weren't dying. So clearly there was something very wrong. And what I later discovered is that in Sarah's own writing, I didn't even believe it at first, because it was, what do you mean you didn't give them anything but milk? Nobody lives on just milk. And he was giving that to adults also. That's all they had, and that's all they was going to give them. So the situation in the missions was pretty horrific. Not only were they imprisoned for life, and separated from their families, but the overall death rate is estimated by a demographer, Robert Jackson, as 90%. The average lifespan for children at some of the missions was an average 4.5 years. At others, it was 7. It was literally a catastrophic collapse of the population. And Sarah, in his own writing, is he upset by this? He notices that they're all dying. He notices that the Gentile or the wild Indians were much healthier than the ones at the prisons. But he almost gleefully says, well, that we have a large harvest of souls. So his concern is that these bodiless souls have floated to heaven, and he seems to have virtually no regard for the people when they're living. Which is truly astounding. And, of course, what the Indians thought of this is never discussed. So life at the missions was a pretty horrific experience. And I'll give you a quote from someone. They were shackled. They were beaten, forced to work all day, all the time. Loads of the kids had hernias. Hernias, all right, from their overwork. And here's a quote of an Englishman who comes by in 1826, and he says that the congregation was arranged on both sides of the building, separated by an aisle where several deputies were stationed with whips, canes, and goads to preserve order and to keep everyone kneeling in a kneeling posture. The end of the church was occupied by guards of soldiers under their arms with fixed bayonets. That was a church service. And quite a number of contemporary observers discussed how utterly depressed and subservient these people were. I mean, it was truly horrific. I mean, imagine you can never escape. So those are the conditions. And I knew about these conditions from my research over the years, and it's widely published in academic literature, not by Catholic universities, of course, but in non-Catholic literature. So when I heard that the church was going to canonize the person who started this system, I really just scratched my head. How could this be? Just how could this be?
And what efforts were made to educate, if you will, to, or maybe that's foolish on my part, perhaps the education was well in place and it didn't matter, but what efforts were made to talk, to contact the Pope towards the prevention of the canonization of Junipero Serra?
Well, there are three parts. There are three stages to canonization. The first one is veneration. That took place in the 1940s. The second was beatification, which took place in 1988. And the third now is canonization. All along, there was great pushback and opposition by natives. But clearly, right now, there's more because of social media, because the Native community is more well-educated, there's been more research, It's been disseminated better. They're more politically active to begin with. So, for example, there's Chairman Valentin Lopez from the Amundsen Tribal Band. He started writing letters to the Pope when he heard about this. Actually, he started writing letters to the Pope even before the announcement went forth. And he started writing letters to the Pope because he and his tribe are descendants from Mission Santa Cruz and Mission San Juan Bautista, outlining the objections. And I myself went with him to see the Holy See in New York and lay forth our objections. He participated. He gave it what's called an intervention, a report before the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues back in May. Was very well received. It's on YouTube. So there's been a huge amount of pushback. And more recently, 55 tribes in California have written letters to the Pope. And the California Tribal Chairmen's Southern California Tribal Chairmen's Association unanimously wrote a letter opposing the canonization. And the California Association of Tribal Governments has also come out, all the members have written a letter opposing the canonization. This is not, you know, it's maybe not covered here on the East Coast very much, but it's a very big issue in California.
Why is it so important, Christine? How does it fit into the contemporary situation, these missions, Junipero Serra? What does it mean for the indigenous population today, such that there must be this kind of critique? And unfortunately, the canonization has occurred. So where should we be going from here?
Well, it's important because there's something called historic trauma, which the Native community, in fact, suffers from, which is not unlike if you don't acknowledge that you've been sexually abused and, you know, and the perpetrator is not brought forward, then in essence, there's just continuing pain from no one acknowledging the truth of your situation. And that's the situation here. When I saw that the Catholic Church was calling Serra a friend of the Indians, and he walked all the way to Mexico City on their behalf, I thought to myself, well, this is pretty bizarre. How could this be? Let me look at the documents. And what I discovered was something pretty alarming. I was trying to find the exact document that they were referring to, and I quickly discovered that the Catholic websites were all talking about how Serra was not only a friend of the Indian and defender of their rights, but he wrote something that could be termed, passive voice, an Indian Bill of Rights. And I went, whoa, an Indian Bill of Rights? I've never heard of such a thing. And what really caught my attention was that if there was, in fact, an Indian Bill of Rights, and they said it were 32 points, why were none of them discussing it? That, to me, was very suspicious. Why not proudly proclaim every one of those rights that he gave the Indians? Well, the short story is I did the research, and I wrote an article on it that appeared in Indian Country Today. It's called Serra Gate, The Fabrication of a Saint. And, in fact, it's not true. And it's not only is it not true, we are talking about some low-level Catholic websites to dream this up. No, you have the archivist emeritus of the Los Angeles diocese using these terms. You have the Archbishop of San Diego using these terms. All right. Insinuating and outright stating, the Catholic Reporter, the Catholic National Reporter, stating that, in fact, yes, this is the first Bill of Rights for, you know, Indians in California. That's a blatant lie, quite frankly. I call it a fabrication, but, you know, if you have deliberately falsified the facts, it's a lie. The document is called Serra did write a document called a representación. It's a representational report. I tracked it down. It does have 32 points. None of those points give rights to the Indians. All of them were put together to give administrative improvements to the missionary system, most important of which, what Sarah asked for and what he got, was exclusive control over the Indians. And before that, he was having a fight with the military commander. He wanted the military commander, whose name was Pedro Fages, he wanted him fired and replaced, and that did occur. And he wanted exclusive authority over the mission Indians, which he got. But the rest of the items are things like, I want more mules. I want you should give more pay to the soldiers.
Well,
we want a regular way of assessing the weights.
Christine, we're going to have to, unfortunately, leave it there. And I want to thank Christine Grabowski, who is the author of Sarahgate, The Fabrication of a Saint, which is published in Indian Country Today. I encourage you to Google that, read the article material. And Christine, I know it's your anniversary and you're going to run to celebrate it. So congratulations.
Thank you.
And thank you for spending some time with us on these very, very interesting and important issues.
Here.
It's a pleasure to have you.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.
St. Marie.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
We do not pity gay persons, but we recognize them for who they are. They are our sons and daughters and brothers and sisters.
I have known the Pope since 1964 in my high school as a teacher. When I introduced him to my boyfriend, he says, "Of course, yes, I remember you. We met in Rome in San Pietro."
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappelle. A British appeals court denies same-gender couples' pensions parity, a pro-equality Obama resists endorsing the Equality Act, and LGBT issues strain a conflicted Catholic synod on the family. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Michael Lebeau.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending October 10th, 2015. A gay man in the UK lost his legal bid this week for equal pension benefits for married same-gender couples. While elderly heterosexual couples have decades to accrue partner benefits on private pension plans, many plans only offer entitlements to same-gender couples dating back to 2005, when civil partnerships were first introduced for lesbian and gay couples, and then to legally married couples when the civil institution was opened to them in 2013. 62-year-old John Walker and his spouse registered as civil partners in 2006, which was eventually converted to a civil marriage. He challenged current laws that allow him to leave no more than £500 of his pension to his husband when he dies. According to the BBC, Walker worked for a major chemical company for 23 years, building up an annual pension worth about £85,000. If Walker divorced his husband and married a woman, his lawyers argued his wife would receive not £500 but £41,000. Yet the Court of Appeal threw out the challenge to the status quo. Lord Justice Underhill wrote that changes in social attitudes and the legislation which embodies those changes cannot fully undo the effects of the past.
Walker told the London Telegraph that it was utterly reprehensible that he had given more than two decades to his employer, Innospec, which he described as a large, successful company with a pension fund surplus, yet, he said, my husband of more than 20 years will be entitled to nothing from the company on my death. A number of MPs from all sides of the political spectrum have called on the government to close the loophole in the Marriage Same-Sex Couples Act. But the Cameron government has warned that it would be too expensive, about £3.3 billion, and some believe that the appeals court ruling will reinforce that resistance. A media statement from the UK's largest LGBT advocacy group, Stonewall, complained that equality should not be denied on the basis of cost.
Meanwhile, U.S. President Barack Obama has yet to endorse the Equality Act, a much broader version of the earlier Employment Non-Discrimination Act, or ENDA, which never made it out of both houses of Congress at the same time during its several incarnations. The Equality Act would go beyond outlawing anti-LGBT workplace bias and would expand the all-encompassing Civil Rights Act of 1964 to include sexual orientation and gender identity. All 170 co-sponsors of the bill in the House and 39 co-sponsors in the Senate are Democrats. Presidential spokesman Josh Earnest responded to a question about Obama's hesitation this week from the Washington Blade's Chris Johnson.
The president believes that we must ensure all Americans are treated equally under federal law. And the president believes the passage of comprehensive legislation that protects LGBT Americans from discrimination would mark an important step toward that outcome. So we would applaud the efforts of members of Congress to try to advance that goal. But when it comes to this specific piece of legislation, something that's still under review by the administration.
Why is review still ongoing? What reason is there not to endorse legislation right now?
Yeah, and it's just simply that this particular piece of legislation, the way that it's written, would have a significant impact across a broad set of policies. And so the administration wants to take a careful look to make sure that we understand the broad impact that this particular piece of legislation would have. But this is a review that's ongoing, and we'll keep you posted.
The president is not alone in staying on the Equality Act sidelines right now. Even though the proposal has drawn the backing of Apple and some other big companies, and most recently from Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton and possible candidate and current Vice President Joe Biden. But the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights and the NAACP have yet to endorse the bill. Their concerns are shared by the grassroots LGBT rights group Get Equal, that opening the iconic piece of American civil rights legislation to congressional amendment could wind up weakening the entire law.
In other news, the Federal Court of Malaysia has overturned a landmark lower court decision that struck down a ban on transgender women wearing women's clothing. The Putrajaya Court of Appeal ruled eloquently last November that the law forbidding Muslim transgender women from wearing women's clothing was unlawful because it violated their constitutional right of freedom of expression and the right to live in dignity and equality. Transgender women are routinely arrested in Malaysia because of the clothing they choose to wear. Three transgender women who were previously prosecuted for the offense challenged the law in court. But the Southeast Asian nation's highest court, ruling on procedural grounds this week, essentially upheld Sharia, or Islamic law, that prohibits a male person posing as a woman. A statement from Human Rights Watch echoed the sentiment of several other global equality groups. Trans women in Malaysia face horrific abuses every day, it read, and laws that criminalize their very identity constitute a barrier to justice. LGBT rights are generally non-existent in Malaysia, where Islam is the official state religion, and Sharia often supersedes secular law.
Poland's president, Andrzej Duda, vetoed a landmark piece of legislation this week, written by the country's out-trans MP, Anna Grodzka, that would have allowed any citizen in the Eastern European nation to change her or his legal gender simply by submitting supportive documents from two experts in the field. The Council of Europe has called on all member states to eliminate abusive requirements for the legal change, such as forced sterilization or medical intervention. Current Polish law requires gender reassignment surgery. Even though the Gender Accordance Act passed with a significant majority, 252 MPs for, 158 against, and 11 abstentions, an override of a presidential veto requires a three-fifths majority. A statement from the European Parliament's Intergroup on LGBTI rights condemned Duda's unwillingness to recognize trans people and his disrespect for human rights as a whole.
But the chief minister of the Isle of Man has come out as a gay man. Alan Bell announced the launch of a public consultation on marriage equality last week in the autonomous British Crown dependency. Legislation to open civil marriage to same-gender couples is expected to be introduced in the Isle's Parliament sometime next year. Bell told the Guardian newspaper this week that, "People know that I'm gay. I've never made a secret of it, but no one has ever asked me." He's been in a long-term relationship with another man for the past 21 years in what the Guardian described as an open secret. Consensual adult gay sex was only decriminalized on the Isle of Man in 1992, but Bell told the newspaper that he's been bolstered by the public reaction to last week's beginning of the marriage equality process. "I've not heard a single negative reaction to it," he said, "and that's quite heartening."
The coach of a top-tier U.S. National Collegiate Athletic Association basketball team became the first in his profession to come out this week. Chris Burns is assistant coach in Smithfield, Rhode Island, for the Division I Bryant University Bulldogs, where he was once a star player. He described exclusively to Outsports.com how growing up deeply closeted in rural New Hampshire was a scary proposition. He said he first came out to supportive head coach Tim O'Shea and then to players in the Bulldogs' locker room. "There are parts of this business that lead me to believe what I'm about to tell you is not acceptable here," he said. The players were wide-eyed, Burns said, and then he took a deep breath and finally said, "I'm a gay man." So how did the players react? Burns said they hugged him and told him they loved him. "There was an initial shock factor," senior forward Chris Oakley told USA Today, "but everyone was like, 'Yo, Burns, we rockin' with you.' It was all love." "There is no greater feeling than being a part of something bigger than just you," Burns wrote on Outsports.com. "That's what has always made sports so special for me." But the road ahead won't be easy for the Bryant University Bulldogs. They start their 2015-2016 season later this year with a visit to the defending national champion, Duke University Blue Devils.
And finally, in this week's Kim Davis News, the born-again marriage equality-resistant Rowan County, Kentucky clerk has been offered a queen's ransom to get a little out of her comfort zone. Well, maybe a lot. The Dogfart Network, yes, that's the actual name of the company, says it will pay Davis $500,000 if she'll do an interracial lesbian porn scene for its Zebra Girls collection. We have always believed in equality, and we think Kim Davis has been appalling, a Dogfart media statement said. We are giving her a chance at a redemption. The company is also inviting Davis to bring her family with her during the shoot for an all-expenses-paid vacation.
That's News Wrap for the week ending October 10th, 2015. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
I think that he basically was set up for this meeting with Mrs. Davis. I think that he was extremely surprised. I was very surprised and very suspicious from the very beginning.
Light some incense and get ready for a procession of dissident voices in the Roman Catholic Church later in the program.
Here come the lesbians. Here come the leaving lesbians.
Ice fingers, feeling, stealing, reaching out from floors and ceilings. You can't escape, you're in our hands.
Here come the lesbians.
Wilna Hervey and Nan Mason were living large in the 1920s, and Therese and Isabel ran afoul of the censors in the 60s. Their stories make for great reading in the valued opinion of Queer Life and Lit commentator Janet Mason.
Recently, I read two books, Therese and Isabel by Violet LeDuc, originally censored but in 2015 published by the Feminist Press, and Living Large, Wilna Hervey and Nan Mason, 2015, by Joseph P. Eckhart. Living Large is billed as a rollicking dual biography of one of America's earliest out-and-proud same-sex couples, and it does not disappoint. Eckhart did a thorough and meticulous job of telling us the story of their lives and relationship. Wilna Hervey was a comedic silent film star. Nan Mason was the daughter of Wilna's co-star and friend Dan Mason, and the two women hit off with a father's blessing. Nan and Wilna were both visual artists, and in 1924 they moved to an art colony in the Catskills, which became their permanent home. In the epilogue, Eckhart writes, "It is their enthusiasm, their eagerness to explore the adventures that each new day might bring, and their joy in sharing them with each other, that the most important legacy of Wilna Hervey and Nan Mason is to be found. Their enduring companionship serves to remind us of a profound and timeless truth. Enthusiasm and love are the secrets to a happy life, and the essence of living large." Eckhart emphasizes that Wilna and Nan did not experience discrimination based on their sexual orientation. This is unusual, but it is easy to believe. They lived protected lives as artists in a community of artists and also came from protected class backgrounds. Still, Living Large left me with some questions. Would Wilna Hervey be as well known as Charlie Chaplin if it wasn't for the sexism and heterosexism of the time? Would they have had better luck as artists if the climate were different? In particular, the artwork and fine art photography by Nan Mason that is reproduced in the book is nothing short of stunning. We may never know, but it is no small thing that we know about their lives in Living Large. Therese and Isabel by Violet LeDuc was censored in the author's time, but in 2015 was published by the Feminist Press, which explains, in 1966, when it was originally published in France, the text was censored because of its explicit depiction of young homosexuality. With this publication, the original, unexpurgated text, a stunning literary portrayal of female desire and sexuality, is available to a U.S. audience for the first time. LeDuc lived from 1907 to 1972. Simone de Beauvoir was her close friend and champion. Even so, she was ahead of her time and was largely unrecognized in her lifetime, with the exception of her autobiography, La Bâtarde, published in 1964. Still, as a writer, she accomplished her goals. The sensuous language is not reserved for the erotic scenes, but stay with the reader as the protagonists turn from lovers back into schoolgirls. Girls flew off toward their violins, their primers, their pianos. Hers is a language that captures the subtlety of forbidden love. I linked my arm in hers, twining together our fingers made love. The book includes two essays at the end. In A Story of Censorship by Carlo Gianzetti and the afterword by Michael Lucy, we learn about Leduc's struggles as an author, including the heartbreak of censorship. Despite the way that she may have felt in her lifetime, Leduc's work endures, and it is absolutely necessary. This is Janet Mason with commentary on queer life and literature for This Way Out.
Living Large is published by Woodstock Arts Press, and Therese and Isabel is published by The Feminist Press.
I'm Diddly Day, an actor's life is gay. It's great to be a celebrity, an actor's life for me.
Every actor worth his salt strives to be honest and true in his portrayals on the stage or screen. Hello, this is Ian McKellen, and that's exactly what This Way Out does as well, right here on this station.
Attention all LGBT, U.S. history buffs, collectors, and listener supporters. You can now own a very special edition of This Way Out. Here's a taste.
Today, being gay is not a crime.
This is going to lead to the legalization of same-sex marriage.
Children born today will grow up in a world without DOMA.
This is social engineering by a court.
Hi, is this Jim?
Yes, it is, Mr. President.
I just want to say congratulations.
Today, some of the darkest 24 hours in our nation's history.
It's the day I finally get to look at the man that I love and finally say, will you please marry me?
From Outlaws to In-Laws traces the legal evolution of the U.S. Supreme Court, from decriminalization of private consensual adult gay sex in 2003 to making marriage equality the law of the land in 2015.
This special edition features the voices of dozens of equality advocates over those years who made the journey possible, despite always outspoken opposition along the way. From Outlaws to In-Laws also includes a wide variety of thematic music.
You'll find all the info you need about this very special edition of This Way Out at thiswayout.org.
First you get down on your knees, fiddle with your rosaries, bow your head with great respect and genuflect, genuflect, genuflect. Do whatever steps you want if you have cleared them with the pontiff. Everybody say his own, Kyrie eleison, doing the Vatican right.
Coming right on the heels of the Pope's sometimes controversial trip to the U.S., the Vatican's three-week-long Synod on the Family began with even more heated headlines on the status of LGBT Roman Catholics. Conservatives attended a pre-synod conference, while the Global Network of Rainbow Catholics held their own gathering in Rome to press the synod to move forward on LGBT issues. That effort was propelled to the fore by the dramatic coming out and firing of a member of the powerful Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. Monsignor Christoph Karamsa said that he's not only gay, but is in a long-term relationship. A Vatican spokesperson said Karamsa was fired not so much for being gay, but for strategically timing his announcement to highlight the LGBT debate at the Synod to the detriment of other family issues like divorce, immigration, and war. As the Synod itself got underway, six bishops supported the idea of a new pastoral approach to a complex modern world. Vatican assistant the Reverend Thomas Rosica explained to the press some of those bishops' thinking.
Themes of poverty, unemployment, migration, war, and this massive refugee problem that's taking place that are huge challenges for marriage. Second point, there must be an end to exclusionary language and a strong emphasis on embracing reality as it is, and we should not be afraid of new and complex situations. The language must be renewed, and there was a close link made with the Jubilee of Mercy. The Jubilee of Mercy that will begin in December also requires a new form of language, both public and private. The Jubilee of Mercy requires a language of mercy. In particular, in speaking about homosexuals or gay persons, we do not pity gay persons, but we recognize them for who they are. They are our sons and daughters and brothers and sisters.
Lurking behind the official discussions remain the actions of Pope Francis himself. It's now widely believed that his alleged endorsement of Rowan County, Kentucky Clerk Kim Davis's refusal to grant legal marriage licenses to same-gender couples was a setup by a conservative Vatican emissary in the U.S. to embarrass the pontiff. An audience the Pope actually granted while in the U.S. tells a different story. MSNBC's Lawrence O'Donnell spoke with friend of Francis, Yayo Grassi, with additional analysis from Washington Post columnist E.J. Dion.
The Vatican has released a statement about the controversial meeting between Pope Francis and Kentucky County Clerk Kim Davis. The statement says, "The Pope did not enter into the details of the situation of Mrs. Davis, and his meeting with her should not be considered a form of support of her position in all of its particular and complex aspects." The Vatican statement also revealed that, quote, "The only real audience granted by the Pope was with one of his former students and his family. That former student was Yayo Grassi, who arrived with members of his family, also with his boyfriend of 19 years. Joining us now is Yayo Grassi. With us, E.J. Dion. Mr. Grassi, how long have you known the Pope?
I have known the Pope since 1964. When he came into my high school as a teacher.
And how did you arrange this meeting in Washington?
Well, I have met the Pope before, a couple of months after he was elected Pope in Rome, in a trip that was planned way before he was elected Pope. And I had a general audience with him in Piazza San Pietro. He met then my boyfriend, and when I heard that he was coming to Washington, I wrote him an email asking if he had time that I would like to see him here. He immediately replied saying yes. Then I realized that his schedule was so exhausting and so demanding that I wrote him back saying, perhaps it's better if we see each other some other time, take the time to use it for better ends. And so he called me one morning and my cell phone, and basically in a conversation of about 10, 12 minutes, he repeated twice that he would like to give me a hug when he was in Washington and told me how to arrange the meeting, and so I did.
And so he has met your boyfriend before, and he knows he's your boyfriend.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, 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 yes. When I introduced him to my boyfriend, he says, of course, yes, I remember you. We met in Rome, in San Pietro.
E.J. Dion, put all of this now in context with what we know about the Kim Davis meeting.
Well, you know, we were talking about that a lot last week. And it seemed very unlikely that this pope, given everything he did during that trip, given not that he supports gay marriage at all, but his openness toward people regardless of their sexual preference, that he would back up what Kim Davis did. And it turned out that he didn't. And I think this raises a lot of questions still that have to be answered. Was it the nuncio? It looks like the nuncio invited her. Why did he do that? Why did he put the Pope in that position? Then a lot of people went off on that meeting and said, see, despite the Pope's careful statements here, he really supports Kim Davis. Well, that's not who the Pope is. And the fact that the Vatican went out of its way then to show the film of the meeting with Mr. Grassi, which looks really heartwarming, I think that sent the most powerful message the Vatican could send.
Mr. Grassi, knowing the Pope as you do, and that's not a phrase I have used on this program before with anyone, but what is your judgment about that meeting? Because the Pope was, it seems to me, very careful not to step into the most controversial areas or the most politically difficult areas. He never mentioned the word abortion, for example, when he was speaking to Congress. And so it seemed incongruous to me that he would then, through an audience with Kim Davis, step into this incredibly controversial issue in the United States?
I think that that he basically was set up for this meeting with Mrs. Davis. I think that he was extremely surprised. I was very surprised and very suspicious from the very beginning that this was not something that came naturally from the Pope as an invitation. When things started to come out was when I realized, I think that I know who was behind this. And I honestly wouldn't have said anything, wouldn't have been that the Vatican press office released that statement, and somehow the press got a hold on me. And to me was that is basically what happened.
E.J. Dionne, thanks for joining us tonight. And Yo-Yo Grassi, thank you very much for joining us tonight. And
thank you,
Lauren. Just to learn that the Pope is emailing his friends about getting together is one of the big revelations of tonight.
MSNBC's Lawrence O'Donnell spoke with friend of Francis, Yo-Yo Grassi, with additional analysis from Washington Post columnist E.J. Dionne.
Get in line in that processional, step into that small confessional. There the guy who's got religion will tell you if your sin's original. If it is, try playing it safer, drink the wine and chew the wafer. 2, 4, 6, 8, time to transubstantiate us. So get down upon your knees, fiddle with your rosaries, bow your head with great respect and genuflect. Make a cross on your abdomen, when in Rome do like a Roman. Ave Maria, gee, it's good to see you. Getting ecstatic and sort of dramatic and doing the Vatican right.
If you're gay, then you're gay. Don't pretend that you're straight. You could be who you are any day of the week. You are unlike the others, so strong and unique. We're all with you.
If you're straight, well, that's great. You can help procreate and make gay little babies for the whole human race. Make a world we can live in where the one who you love's not an issue.
And we're all here in it together. We're one step closer to breaking down the walls.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Michael LeBeau, Wenzel Jones, Janet Mason, Jason Proctor, and Abby Dees contributed program material, with thanks as always to Steve Pride. Sue Fink, Tom Lehrer, and A Great Big World performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this program possible. You'll find more information about the show, the crew, our social media links, and more at thiswayout.org. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org, on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher, and on WGOT Gainesville, Florida, Radio Reverb, Brighton, England, WDHF Ossining, New York, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Against the grain, slavery in the U.S. involved the buying and selling of black bodies, and it was white men who did the buying and selling, right? I'm CS. Historian Stephanie Jones Rogers calls into question that piece of conventional wisdom and many others. She joins me coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. How involved were white women in the buying and selling of black bodies in the U.S. South? Stephanie Jones Rogers has come up with an answer that, well, cuts against the grain of conventional understandings. Jones Rogers has asserted, in a dissertation she wrote and a number of papers she's presented, that white women were active participants in the slave trade, that their economic relationship to and investment in the institution of slavery has been largely ignored by historians. Stephanie Jones Rogers is assistant professor of history at UC Berkeley. She's working on a book about white women and the economics of slavery in the U.S. She's also investigated the power of slave owners to go into so-called free states and claim runaway slaves. When Stephanie Jones Rogers joined me in studio, I asked her how much historians who have studied and written about U.S. slavery, how much they have focused on men, on the men who bought and sold slaves.
They've pretty much focused all of their attention on the men, particularly the white men, who were engaged in the buying and selling of enslaved people. And in fact, one of the historians who is well known for his monograph on the antebellum slave market, Walter Johnson, who is a professor at Harvard, really leads the kind of forefront of the scholarship. And his argument has, I think, laid the groundwork for much of the scholarship that it's come after. His book was published in 1999 and then in 2000. And he argues that women, in fact, had no business in the slave market, in part because it was a site of perceived sexual disorder and there was no place for a white lady to be. So based upon that really, I think, provocative argument, scholars that have come after him have taken that as fact and have built their own arguments upon that contention about women's exclusion from this space. So it really has been a very masculinist and heavily male-centered scholarship on the slave market and the domestic slave trade more broadly.
In making that argument, doesn't Professor Johnson kind of rely on certain evidence and certain writings from that period about who appeared at slave markets, who did the actual buying and selling?
Absolutely. So he does look at a number of slave traders' business ledgers and account books. He looks at the papers, so the correspondence and letters of slave owners themselves and planters and also prospective slave owners. He also looks at court cases and the documents that would have been given to slave owners after they purchased enslaved people. These were called bills of sale. So they would be like receipts that we receive today when we purchase something. So he looked at those documents and he did indeed build his argument upon the documentation that he looked at in the archives that he examined. However, I too looked at some of the same sources, the same archival collections, and found women throughout including slave traders' business ledgers. There are a number of slave traders who did business directly with women, both as prospective buyers as well as individuals who had enslaved people who they wanted to sell, and also for individuals who were entrepreneurs. So, for example, women who made dresses for a living, dressmakers, may work for or be hired by slave traders who would pay them in order to make dresses for the enslaved women who they planned to sell. So women were involved in a host of ways, and they appear in the same sources and documents that Walter Johnson uses and other historians have used as well to kind of construct this argument about women's exclusion from the slave market.
Well, tell us about a woman named Anne Robertson and how involved she got in the purchasing and selling of black bodies in the years following the American Revolution.
So Anne Robertson was a married woman, and this is quite exceptional because during this period of time, there was a legal doctrine called coverture. And under coverture, a married woman essentially lost her independent legal and economic identity. And she and her husband became one person. So her husband then became kind of the spokesman of both the husband and the wife. Also, any woman who owned property prior to her marriage, that property would become her husband's. She essentially relinquished legal title to any property that she may hold. But in Anne Robertson's case, she was a married woman, and she was able to go into the Charleston, South Carolina slave market. She would attend auctions in the slave market in Charleston. She would seek out sickly slaves, so slaves who were suffering from some kind of ailment, and then she would buy them at very cheap prices because it's kind of like when you go into your supermarket and they have bruised fruit or packages that are damaged, and they might have a reduced price on those items. This is essentially what Anne Robertson did. She would buy enslaved people who were unwell, and they would give her these enslaved people for far lower prices than healthy enslaved people. She would nurse them back to health, and then she would resell. So she would sell them in the slave market as healthy people, and she would profit from doing this, investing this time, and then selling these enslaved people thereafter. And she did all this while she was married to John Robertson. John would often warn his wife about very risky bidding behavior. He warned her that this was not a sound business strategy, and she would, you know, tell him to leave her alone. And it was her money, and she'd do what she wanted with it. But when she passed away in the late 1790s, she had accumulated a sizable estate, and she was able to accumulate this sizable estate in her own name. So contrary to this legal doctrine of coverture, she was able to maintain legal title to this property, and she also was able to pass that on. So she died without a will, but her mother found out that she had this property, and her mother sued to be the heir. And she actually won her case. So Anne Robertson was able to do this because of her engagement, her direct engagement in slave market activities in a period of time when women, you know, probably shouldn't have been able to do that. But Anne Robertson was able to do that while married to John, and her mother was able to actually benefit from her labor in the slave market.
So Anne Robertson, she was able to retain title to even her human property, even though she was married.
Absolutely. So when she died, her husband passed away before her. But the court case that her mother brought really was quite revealing because the administrators of her husband's estate, as well as her own estate, they were the same individuals, basically tried to merge the two individuals, the John and Anne's estates, together. But her mother, you know, argued that everyone in Anne's community had recognized her as an independent, what's called a femme sole. So she operated as a femme sole, which was a woman who was married, who could conduct business in her own name, who could own property in her own name, who could enter legal suits in her own name without her husband's permission. They argued in the community that she operated as a femme sole, and because she behaved in this way, even if she wasn't legally recognized by the courts as a femme sole, that she was entitled to hold this property in her own name. And so her mother argued this in the case, and the administrators, of course, contested this. But the judge, the court, actually upheld her mother's argument.
So Anne Robertson, she goes to the slave market, I guess, in spite of or not deterred by the sexualized atmosphere of that venue. She bought slaves. She sold them later for profit. What about Annie Poore, P-O-O-R-E? Did she go to the slave markets also to acquire slaves?
Absolutely not. And that's the interesting thing that connects to the scholarship, the kind of masculine view of the slave market in contemporary scholarship about the slave trade. So, for example, Walter Johnson, again, he argues that if women did, on exceptional cases, conduct business in the slave market, they would often find ways to do that without entering the slave market proper. And so there's kind of this distancing of women from this space because of all the reasons why I, you know, outlined before. However, Annie Poore, she found a really an amazing way to conduct business outside of the slave market by creating a slave market of her own making. So she actually used her landscape, her plantation landscape. She constructed an auction block. She would train the slaves that she owned to be particular kinds of laborers. So she would make them seamstresses. She would teach them how to sew. She would, you know, make sure that they were excellent laundresses. They would be excellent carpenters and blacksmiths. And then she would sell them on her plantation, on an auction block she built right there on her own, in her own household. So she didn't actually have to go to the slave market because the slave market came to her. She actually constructed her own slave market. She was her own slave master, her own slave trader, and she was her own auctioneer. You know, in and of herself, she was all of those things.
Stephanie Jones Rogers teaches history at UC Berkeley. And she joins us on Against the Grain to talk about her research into white women and the economy of U.S. slavery. I'm C.S., and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you're pointing to Ann Robertson, Annie Poore. You've written about other women. I mean, do we have any sense of how many women participated directly in the buying and selling of slaves in the U.S. around this time, or any sense of maybe the proportion of slave traders who were women?
Well, unfortunately, we don't have a clear indication of the precise number of women that were involved, in part because historians, you know, have for a very long time, you know, assumed that there just weren't any women there. So because the assumption existed for quite a long time, you know, most historians, when they did a lot of quantitative data, didn't even pay attention to gender variables when it came to the owners. So, for example, some historians have actually done quantitative data which looks at enslaved populations who were being bought and sold and looked at, you know, whether there were more men being sold, whether there were more enslaved females being sold, and the prices that they commanded. But when it comes to the individuals who owned those enslaved people, the gender of those individuals has never actually entered the quantitative data. So the slave owners are kind of by default male in much of the data that's been collected. And so what I've been doing is trying to collect the data that shows how many women, exactly how many women are, number one, on the ground buying and selling enslaved people. And there are a lot of them, I can tell you that. I haven't yet completed that quantitative data collection. And in terms of the women who are actually working in the slave market, that too is very difficult to determine, in part because you never quite know whether a man is actually doing business on behalf of a woman. For example, in New Orleans, there were many white men who served as agents for white women. So they would buy and sell slaves on behalf of white women, but they would serve as their agent. And so sometimes what looks like a man's slave market activities is really a woman's slave market activities. So that makes it very difficult to actually accurately count how many women are working in the slave market. In addition to that, women worked indirectly with slave traders, as I mentioned, you know, offering them goods and services. So there were hundreds of women in cities like New Orleans who operated grocery stores or, you know, coal dealers or, you know, all kinds of things, boarding houses, hotels, where they offered accommodations for, you know, slave traders as well as the slaves that they hoped to buy and sell. So there are hundreds of women doing that in small, you know, cities like New Orleans, but across the entire region, you could say thousands of women are either directly or indirectly involved in the slave trade.
You've written that the spatial configuration of commercial districts in many 19th century U.S. cities made it very difficult for white women to avoid slave marketplaces.
Absolutely. So, for example, in the city of New Orleans or the city of Charleston, the commercial centers of these kinds of cities and towns were the actual home hosts for the slave market. So these slave markets weren't separate or distinct from the commercial centers of southern cities and towns. They were a fundamental part of these southern cities and towns. So, for example, you can go to New Orleans today, and the Royal Omni Hotel is on Royal Street, right in the center of the French Quarter. That was one of the largest slave markets or slave auction sites in the 19th century South. It was the St. Louis Hotel, and it's right in the center of the city of New Orleans. And so this is what I mean by women are walking these streets. They are buying and selling dresses, and they're going in and out of, you know, boutiques and stores, and they're seeing enslaved people marching to places like the St. Louis Hotel, marching through corridor called the Exchange Alley, which was filled with lawyers and auctioneers and commission merchants, who are individuals who kind of bought and sold all kinds of things on behalf of other people. So they're seeing and engaging and encountering the slave market on the streets, but also in the places where they stayed. So, you know, visitors, women who visited the city of New Orleans, often stayed in the St. Louis Hotel, and they would remark upon the fact that when they left the hotel, they would walk right past the slave auctions in the rotunda, which was right downstairs. So these women, whether they lived in the city of New Orleans, whether they worked there, or whether they were visiting, just simply could not avoid the slave market because it really was everywhere.
Give us an example of a slave trader, a male slave trader, who sought out white women's services, services that could help him more efficiently ply his trade.
So there was an enslaved woman named Bethany Vini, who was being held by a jailer, a local jailer, who was going to be exposing her for sale in the slave market in, you know, in a couple of days or a week or so. And he actually had her and another enslaved woman who was similarly held in his jail, had them taken to a local dressmaker who then created dresses specifically for their sale day. So she made these dresses specifically for them to wear on the auction block in a few days. And this man who was holding them in captivity and who would be responsible for those sales hired her to create, to make these dresses for Bethany and this other woman.
So in other words, it's all about, at this point, making them as attractive as possible to prospective buyers.
Absolutely. Bethany, you know, she says that the style of the dress actually was so gaudy that it was certainly made specifically to attract attention, not just attention of regular run-of-the-mill buyers, but also those buyers who would be interested in the fancy trade. So buyers who may be seeking out a sexual laborer as well. So she absolutely made this dress in such a way that it would attract both the attention of your run-of-the-mill slave buyer, but also a buyer who was interested in the bodies, the sexualized bodies of these enslaved women.
I think American slavery, in many people's minds, makes people think of, you know, people bought and sold to work on the plantation, to work in the fields, to do labor of an agricultural or domestic kind. And you point to the fact that there was slavery for another purpose. What was the fancy trade?
So the fancy trade was a kind of sector of the slave market whereby slave traders sold typically very light-skinned, racially mixed enslaved women for the sole purpose of sex. So it was a form of sexual slavery. So it was a market in sexual slavery. And what I often found or, you know, encounter, you often find this particular sector of the slave market highly masculinized as well. So historians have argued that, you know, slave traders would not only sell these women for the purpose of sex, but would also exploit them sexually while they were in their custody. But rarely do these historians talk about the fact that cities like New Orleans, for example, had plenty of brothels, and those brothels were operated, owned and operated oftentimes by women. And women, too, they would often, you know, buy enslaved women to serve as sexual laborers in their brothels.
So in other words, we have the added element of sexual violence, not to say that sexual violence did not occur on plantations, but I think the suggestion I get from your writing is that, you know, these women really knew what they were doing in terms of the specifically the sexual exploitation of these enslaved women and girls.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the reality is that while we typically associate sexual violence with men, you know, our own government has quite recently revised its own definition of what rape is to include all kinds of perpetrators, male as well as female perpetrators, all kinds of different forms of sexual violence as well. So we have a far more expansive understanding of sexual violence today than they did then. But if we think about the fact that these particular women bought enslaved women for the sole purpose of sexual labor, and they did this over and over again, so they sold these women's bodies over and over again, they profited from the continued and persistent sexual assault of enslaved women's bodies. And they knew that. They absolutely knew that.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My guest in studio is Stephanie Jones Rogers. She is an assistant professor of history at UC Berkeley. She's working on a book about white women and the economy of American slavery. Its tentative title is Mistresses of the Market. It will be published by Yale University Press. And the book draws on a dissertation she wrote about slave-owning women and the gendered politics of the antebellum slave market. That dissertation, written while she was at Rutgers, won the 2013 Lerner Scott Prize for the best dissertation in women's history from the Organization of American Historians. So some of your work really calls into question this idea that it was exclusively men who did the slave trading in the U.S. South. And some of your other research calls into question this notion of, well, there were, you know, slave states and there were free states. And so if somehow a slave could get to a, quote, free state, everything would be fine. And you begin a paper on this issue with a story about Mary Martin. So she was a white woman in New Orleans who in 1830 bought an enslaved man named Jack. Shortly thereafter, Jack ran away and Mary searched for him, as you might expect, for several months without success. What then did Mary do?
Well, what Mary did first is she thought, I'm going to get my money back. So she argued that the man who sold Jack to her, a well-known slave trader named John Woolfolk, that Woolfolk knew that Jack was a runaway. And there was a law in New Orleans which allowed for people who bought slaves to petition for their money back if they could prove that the enslaved person that they purchased was faulty in some way. And so Mary drew upon that law and argued that Woolfolk knew that Jack had a tendency to run away from his former masters and sold him anyway, but did not disclose that to her when she purchased him. And beyond on those grounds, she wanted her money back. The judge called upon other witnesses who testified contrary to that. And so because they did not support Mary's contentions, the court dismissed her case. She didn't stop there. She continued to look for Jack, and she found him 2 years later in New York City. And so she went into New York City. She traveled to New York City. She found out where Jack was, and she went into the courts of New York City, and she petitioned for their assistance.
Now, wait. So, but New York was a free state. So wouldn't you expect then that Jack, having made it all the way to New York from New Orleans, that he had achieved freedom? I mean, he was living at that point as a free man.
That's what you would imagine. I mean, I think, our contemporary prevailing understandings of the North in this period of time is that this was a free space, that this was a space where if you could follow the North Star to the North, you could, in fact, be free. Well, in fact, that's an inaccurate assumption, an inaccurate kind of characterization of the North. Up until 1865, there were not only northern states that continued to have some form of servitude in place. New Jersey, for example, continued to have a form of servitude in place until 1865. But the laws in these states not only supported slave ownership, they allowed for slave owners to bring their slaves with them into the state. In New York, especially, slave owners could keep their slaves with them for up to 9 months if they were just visiting. But if they chose to stay in New York permanently, so to become a permanent resident, they could actually complete a form and provide the state with a few details about themselves and the enslaved people they had with them. And they were permitted to keep their slaves with them in perpetuity. So they were allowed to keep them enslaved in a so-called free state. Coupled with New York laws, there were federal laws that allowed for this to happen as well. So it started with the Constitution. There's a clause in the Constitution which allows for any slave owner to hunt down and capture any enslaved person who runs away from them into a state that does not recognize slavery and to claim them and take them back home. So the Constitution allows for that, and it was actually strengthened. That provision within the Constitution was strengthened with the Fugitive Slave Act of 1793 and also the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. So enslaved people were not actually freed immediately upon reaching the North because of federal laws which prohibited that and actually emboldened and empowered slave owners to reclaim them and to take them back into slavery, but also state-level laws. So in this particular case, New York laws, which supported the federal laws and actually protected slave owners' property rights in human beings.
Did federal or state law impose sanctions on people who hid enslaved people?
Absolutely. So the federal laws, initially the 1793 Act, Fugitive Slave Act, penalized anyone who intervened in the recapturing of enslaved people by fining them. And there was a fine of up to $500 and a prison term, I believe, up to 6 months. And the Fugitive Slave Act actually stiffened the penalty. So I believe it was up to a $1,000 fine that they could actually have to pay. And then that money was not given to the state. It wasn't given to the federal government. It was actually given to the slave owner along with their slave. So if you intervened, you would pay a hefty price. That was a significant amount of money in that time.
That suggests that if you found a fugitive slave, you were actually legally required to return that slave to the slave owner, even in a, quote, free state, such as New York.
Absolutely. So not only did the federal and the state laws embolden or empower slave owners to hunt down and recapture enslaved people who ran away from them, but it also required or obligated the citizens of free states to participate, to be complicit in that recapturing by either penalizing them for intervening or by forcing them to participate in the capturing and actually handing over of enslaved people to the slave owner. So they actually had to comply with the slave owner's demands for their enslaved property.
So Mary Martin, she buys the slave, Jack. He runs away. She pursues him across the country, finds him in New York City. You said that she went to court to essentially claim him. What happened?
Well, it's a really interesting outcome. So initially, you know, Jack appealed the case. He argued that he was a free person based upon Mary's decision to enter the state of New York and to reside in the state of New York permanently. He was actually wrong because he didn't know that New York City actually sided with Mary. So Mary did win her case. She was given a certificate of apprehension to capture Jack, to return him to New Orleans, and And he then appealed that case, that suit, and she eventually made it to the Supreme Court. So her case went to the New York Supreme Court, where they, in fact, ruled in her favor. So she won her case, and she reclaimed Jack, and New York State actually allowed her to do that, and she took him back home.
Stephanie Jones Rogers is an historian based at UC Berkeley. Her work is about reshaping current understandings of white women's economic relationships to slavery in the U.S. We'll take a short break and return and speak more with Stephanie. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Stephanie Jones Rogers teaches history at UC Berkeley. We have a link to her faculty page there on our website, againstthegrain.org. She wrote a dissertation at Rutgers called Nobody Couldn't Sell 'em But Her, Slave-Owning Women, Mastery, and the Gendered Politics of the Antebellum Slave Market. And she is essentially revising and expanding that dissertation into a book. Its tentative title is Mistresses of the Market, to be published by Yale University Press. So in trying to understand, Stephanie, why the focus was, you know, so much on men and male slave traders and male involvement in the slave trade in the U.S. South, you indicate that in many historians' eyes, the colonial era was a, quote, golden age for white women throughout the colonies. Is that true? And how does the answer to that question affect sort of the gendered politics of slavery in the U.S.?
Well, I think the answer is a little bit complicated. So, you know, I think if you look at women across the board, you know, the constraints that those laws, the legal doctrine of coverture, for example, imposed upon their lives was applicable to many women in the colonial period as well as in the 19th century. So I think there's more continuity than change for the most part, because the idea of the golden age really applies to certain groups of women who found themselves facing certain circumstances. For example, there were high rates of widowhood, early widowhood, in certain colonies, in part because of high mortality rates amongst white men. So women would find themselves quite suddenly and prior to having children, widowed very shortly after marriage because their husbands died very quickly. And so they would find themselves in a position of, you know, operating a business, a family business, or coming to own a large amount of property very suddenly. And so they would have to assume certain responsibilities over those businesses and that property. Some women relished those opportunities. Some women, you know, despised and disdained those opportunities and shuddered at the thought of those opportunities. So I think those kinds of circumstances, it certainly holds true that they, you know, those women who seized those opportunities and exercised a certain amount of control that was unusual for women to do at that time, certainly experienced what was called the golden age. But there were far more women that didn't wouldn't describe their lives as being kind of part of a golden age. The same thing can be said for the 19th century. And the reason why historians argue that the colonial period was, you know, this golden age is because the American Revolution is seen as kind of a breaking point, a turning point for women, a lost or missed opportunity because the founding fathers, you know, had a chance to include women in this kind of more expansive vision of the new polity, the new state, the new republic, but chose to exclude them in certain ways. So seeing the American Revolution in this way, historians have argued that the 19th century is a departure, is a break from this earlier period, in part because the founding fathers continued this very legally constrictive kind of regime in the new country, in the new nation. But in fact, when you look at the ways women are operating on the ground, what they're doing on the ground, what their parents are doing on the ground with them, they're actually finding ways to circumvent the legal constraints that I think also characterize the colonial period. So, for example, women were able to get around the constraints of coverture by entering marriage contracts. So the things that we call prenuptial agreements today, they would construct prenuptial agreements at that time, and they would build in provisions that allowed them to continue to exercise control over property. So they were able to continue to maintain their investments in slavery in this way. They would often, you know, ensure that that particular property, their slaves, were protected from their husband's debts by building certain provisions into their prenuptial agreements. So women were able to exercise an extraordinary amount of control over property, even in a time when historians argue that they didn't or they shouldn't have been able to. So I think the answer is both yes and no, that there was a golden age for some women, but for many other women it wasn't. But even for the women who would not describe their lives as being part of a golden age, they still had resources and opportunities available to them to circumvent the constraints imposed upon them by the laws.
Tell us about the federal constitutional clause that abolished the African slave trade to the U.S. Tell us about that clause and how it affected the fortunes of slave-owning women.
What's quite interesting is that most people, they look to the clause within the Constitution, which basically forbade Congress from abolishing the trade from Africa to the United States prior to 1808. It didn't actually abolish it at that time. It said that Congress could not abolish it before 1808. There was subsequent acts of legislation that did, in fact, abolish it in 1808. But most people assume that when the African slave trade was abolished by the federal government, that slavery either remained kind of stagnant or it remained as it was, or that it actually contracted. But what you find is that it expanded in part as a consequence of the abolition of the African slave trade. And the reason why it expanded is because of a series of other events and factors. For example, Western expansion played an important role. The invention of the cotton gin played an important role. But what you see happen is that as the nation expands into the West, white folks that are in the southeastern states move into this new land, and they also begin to cultivate cotton in these new lands, and they need more laborers in these new lands. So because they can no longer get those laborers from Africa, they look inward. They turn their attentions inward, and they look for enslaved laborers within the nation's boundaries. And so in states like Virginia and Maryland, where they're growing tobacco, they're depleting the nutrients in the soil. And what that means is that they have to start to grow other crops that will grow in this nutrient-deficient land. And so they typically grow wheat, and wheat actually doesn't require the same amount of labor as a crop like tobacco does. So slave owners in Virginia and Maryland have these laborers who they don't actually need anymore. And these new planters, these planters in the West who need new laborers, want those enslaved people. So they begin to shift their attention to the enslaved laborers in states like Maryland and Virginia. They command high prices, they buy them, and they then move them into states in the West. So slave traders play a very important role in that movement because they will buy the enslaved people in states like Virginia and Maryland and sell them to the slave owners and planters in these new Western states. And women are some of the individuals who are not just the sellers in the Southeast, but also the buyers in the West. And they certainly profit and benefit from this expansion of the nation, but also the expansion of slavery into these new territories and these new lands.
So in other words, the abolition of the slave trade as far as people from Africa coming to the U.S. resulted in the actual expansion of the domestic slave trade.
Absolutely. So the closure of the African slave trade actually, it served as the basis for the development of a thriving domestic slave trade, an internal slave trade.
Stephanie Jones-Rogers is my guest. She's assistant professor of history at UC Berkeley. We have a link to her faculty page at Berkeley on our website, againstthegrain.org. Well, not just an individual, but a whole family, a family network, became very active, or was very active, in slave trading, did very well financially as a result of this. This is the Woolfolk family. Tell us about them and the slave trading network they created.
Sure. So the Woolfolk family was a very well-known slave trading family. And it began with one of the kind of patriarchs of the family, Austin Woolfolk. And he began his slave trading in Baltimore. And he then involved his brothers as well as his uncle in what became a slave trading firm that branched into a number of southern cities, including New Orleans. They bought slaves in Charleston, Baltimore. So they branched out into some of the most geostrategically positioned slave markets in the South. They also connected these networks with other slave traders. So they would often do business with other slave traders as well as agents. So they would hire men in cities and towns where they had no operation, where their business wasn't actually established, and they would collaborate with them to buy and sell slaves on their behalf as well. So they built pretty much like a southeastern but also regional slave trading network. And they weren't the only ones. That's the extraordinary thing. This was sometimes a family business. So, for example, there was a relatively infamous and notorious slave trader in New Orleans called Bernard Kendig. And what I found is that he was partnered with his aunt. So his aunt, Kendig Bushy, was in cahoots with him. They formed a legal partnership. I've actually found documentation of their legal partnership. And what she would do is she would provide the funds and he would buy and sell. He would often do the majority of the buying and selling. They also had another partner, J.W. Bozeman, who also bought and sold enslaved people. And then she and Bernard would split the profits from those sales down the middle. So these were often family businesses, and not just men, but also women sometimes partnered with their male kin to profit from the slave market. There was another woman, Catherine Hyams, who was originally from Charleston, but traveled to New Orleans, and she operated and owned her own slave yard. And she also had several other male family members who were very active in the slave market. H.M. Hyams actually became the lieutenant governor for Louisiana, and he was a staunch Confederate. So, you know, these were not just male-centered familial businesses or family businesses, but also kind of co-ed family businesses as well in some cases.
One of the many things I find interesting about your work, Stephanie, is, you know, when we hear stories of women defying or circumventing constraints, such as, you know, the fact that the Constitution of the new nation didn't specifically refer to women and women's rights, and given the fact that coverture really, at least legally and formally, made a woman give up all her property when she married. You know, these stories about women becoming liberated or defying these kinds of restraints often suggest that, well, then that they're liberated to do, you know, wonderful things. Well, here you're kind of making the argument that they were in many cases independent and They refuse to be held by the restraints that, you know, either legislators or founders of the Constitution would want them under. And yet, what did they do with it? They participated in a very grisly trade.
Absolutely. I mean, one thing that I've, you know, found over and over again is that, you know, when you think about the fact that these women, from the time they were infants, you know, were essentially born of slavery. They grew up surrounded by slavery. They learned vicarious lessons by watching their parents and other adults engage with enslaved people. Their lives were about slavery, were fundamentally connected to slavery, thrived off of slavery. Then it doesn't seem odd to me or peculiar or strange that once they were old enough to kind of make their own decisions about their financial futures and, you know, their children's financial futures, that they invested heavily economically in the institution of slavery. It doesn't seem odd to me at all when you realize that from the time they're infants, this is all they've known. So it is their lives, and it's quite normal for them to engage in the slave market and slave market activities in the way that they do. When you consider the fact that they have grown up all their lives, you know, kind of surrounded by and immersed in the institution of slavery and overhearing, you know, conversations about the values of enslaved bodies and, you know, separating children, et cetera. This is, you know, commonplace for them. So, yeah, slavery was, in fact, their freedom.
Well, but on the one hand, you could get certain messages, let's say, from your parents about maybe what you're entitled to in terms of services from enslaved people. It's another thing to gain a sense of, well, I control this person, or I'm able to control this person, or I will control this person such that I will be unwilling to relinquish control of that person later on, even if the law technically requires me to do so.
Well, I mean, it's kind of like when you think about the fact that they very rarely heard otherwise. They rarely ever heard, you shouldn't do this. You shouldn't invest in slavery. You shouldn't feel like you can own another human being. That they are actually told from the time they're young children that there are elaborate ceremonies and rituals in which they are given enslaved people at, you know, for example, when they're 21, they're often given an enslaved person. At birthdays, at Christmas, they're given gifts, and those gifts are enslaved people. They are the message that, yes, I can own another human being and I could buy and sell other human beings. That message is relayed to them in a variety of ways throughout their lives. And so the contrary to that, the idea that, no, you can't do this, is not something that they hear routinely. If they hear it, they hear it far less often than they hear, yes, you can do this. Yes, this is your right. Yes, you are entitled to own this body.
I'm C.S. Song. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Stephanie Jones-Rogers is Assistant Professor of History at UC Berkeley. So what got you into researching gender and U.S. slavery in the first place?
Well, I would say Rutgers University definitely was responsible for that. I was, you know, a member of a wonderful, robust intellectual community at Rutgers University in New Jersey. And there were extraordinary scholars of women's and gender history, of African-American history. And I was, you know, under the tutelage of many of those scholars. And so as a graduate student, I was reading all the scholarship about African Americans and reading the scholarship about slavery and reading the scholarship about Southern women in particular. And I noticed that the scholarship on African Americans and on slavery were saying something very different about women's economic investments in the institution of slavery than the scholarship on Southern women. So the scholarship on Southern women, it's arguing, you know, like we've already mentioned here and, you know, talked about today, that, you know, women kind of relinquished any kinds of investments and control in the institution of slavery, you know, especially upon marriage. And that, you know, that's essentially a commonplace kind of assumption in the scholarship on Southern women. Whereas enslaved people and scholars who examine what enslaved people experienced on the ground are arguing something very different. They're showing that women certainly owned enslaved people. They maintained ownership. They secured and protected their rights to their human property throughout their lives. And they were doing this in spite of the law. They were circumventing laws. So there were two very different arguments that were being made in these subfields of history. And so I had a hunch that what enslaved people were saying, since they were in the household, since they were the subjects, the objects of ownership, you know, that they were probably onto something. And so I wanted to find out which story was true. And so that was the beginning of the quest, and that quest began at Rutgers. And I had, you know, these amazing mentors around me encouraging me to pursue my hunch, to find out what was the truth. And so what I found was that, you know, enslaved people, and I should back up a little bit, because in the 1930s, during the Great Depression, the government created what was called the Works Progress or the Works Projects Administration, and they essentially put unemployed people to work. And there was a special unit called the Federal Writers Project. And these individuals were out-of-work writers who went throughout the South, and they tracked down as many formerly enslaved people as they possibly could, and they conducted interviews with them. And those interviews have been collected by the government, and they are actually available online at the Library of Congress's website. And these are essentially formerly enslaved people telling the stories of their lives in bondage. And so when I looked at what they were saying, particularly about women, white women and women who own them, they were saying some extraordinary things about women's continued power and control over their lives. And what I wanted to do was to see if other sources, legal documents, bills of sale, slave traders' records, were substantiating and legitimating what enslaved people were saying. And to my surprise, there were a host of different voices that were saying, absolutely, these women were there. They were invested economically in the institution. They were buying and selling enslaved people. They were profiting in the process. They were supporting the slave market and the slave trade in a host of different ways. And so they were legitimating what enslaved people were saying about white women's economic investments in the institution. And so, yeah, that was really where it began. It was these two kind of contradictory arguments being made in the subfields of women's history and also in the history of African Americans, but also slavery. And I put those two together to find out which one was true. And I found out that enslaved people were, in fact, really giving a fuller picture of white women's investments in their continued bondage.
Did the white women who were active in slave markets, did they write down in records that they left behind how they felt about the morality of what they were doing?
The women rarely did. In fact, and that's, I think, the extraordinary thing, many of these women did not know how to read or write, or they were, you know, marginally literate. So many of them not only didn't leave records behind, but they certainly didn't speak to their sentiments about the institution of slavery. So they were out there conducting business in some of the most active markets in the world. New Orleans was, I believe, the third or fourth largest port in the world.
Wow.
And so you have illiterate women owning, you know, slave yards in this port city and actively engaging in slave market activity in one of the most extraordinary and robust markets in the world. And yet they couldn't even write or they couldn't even read. But nonetheless, I think their actions, you know, this activity says more than we need to know, so far much more about how they felt about the institution than words could ever say. So even though we have this silence, I think their actions, you know, fill that silence and tell us very, very clearly that beyond moral sentiments, they were economically invested in the institution, and those investments were far more important than any kind of aversions that they had to keeping people in bondage.
Stephanie Jones Rogers, she's done extensive research into white women and the economy of U.S. slavery. She wrote about that in her dissertation at Rutgers, and she's now working on a book about that topic. Its tentative title is Mistresses of the Market, to be published by Yale University Press. She's assistant professor of history at UC Berkeley. Stephanie, thanks so much for joining us today.
And thank you so much for having me, CS.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.
I think one of the most important examples of current Indigenous resistance was the Oka Crisis of 1990. The Mohawks of Ganasatagi, a small territory reserve near the township of Oka, were resisting the expansion of a golf course and a condominium setup that was going to infringe on some of the last remaining pines, wooded area that they used for their ceremonies, lacrosse, and part of their graveyard was contained in this area. So in 1989-1990, they started campaigning to stop this. They organized protests. They had petitions. They went to city council in Oka to try to stop this expansion, and the city was just arrogant and just would not listen to the people. They began a blockade of a small dirt road in the pines in Ganasatagi, and they maintained this this little blockade for a few months. The township of Oka tried to get a court injunction to order its removal, and on July 11th, the Quebec Provincial Police sent in a large, heavily armed force of tactical officers armed with M16s and tear gas and that, and they went to dismantle this peaceful blockade. But by that time, warriors had rallied to the defense of this blockade and this struggle to protect the pines. And so behind the protesters, there were armed warriors. And when the police came in shooting tear gas, the warriors engaged them in a short firefight, and one of the police officers was shot and killed. After this shootout, the Quebec police retreated. They abandoned most of their vehicles, and this began a 77-day armed siege of the Mohawk community in Ganasatagi. That same morning, Mohawks in Ganawagi seized the Mercier Bridge, also with arms. They seized the Mercier Bridge to place, as an act of solidarity, but also to place pressure on the Quebec government, because the Mercier Bridge was a vital commuter link into Montreal from the suburbs. And, I mean, 100,000 people a day were using this bridge to get to work and to do their business in the city and that. This siege began. There was thousands of police deployed. Eventually, after a few, 2 or 3 weeks, the Canadian armed forces were deployed. They deployed an entire brigade of 4,500 troops, complete with armored units, armored personnel carriers, tanks, helicopters, jets, artillery units and naval forces as well to contain these two communities of Ganasitagi and Ganawagi. There was mass rioting by the white Quebecois Chateauguay, residents of Chateauguay, a nearby town, demanding that the military go in and crush this uprising. So it really inflamed a lot of the local racial tensions. Across the country, there was a widespread solidarity movement that arose to defend the Mohawks and to and there was protests all across the country, occupations of government offices, occupations and shutting down of bridges, railway lines. There was sabotage, electrical pylons were downed, bridges were burned. So the government of Canada was facing an insurgency that was arising from this standoff. And this was the main contributing factor, of course, that limited the military violence by the government. And the 77-day siege ended when the armed Mohawks burned their weapons and walked out of the final area that they had been contained in. But they refused to surrender, and they got into clashes with the military and the police as they tried to enter this area. But that was the ending of the 77-day siege. Something like 30 or 40 of these people were later acquitted on the grounds of self-defense in court. And the golf course and the condominium project were never expanded. So the Mohawks were victorious. And not only were they victorious in their local struggle, but they helped inspire Indigenous resistance and set the tone for Indigenous resistance throughout the rest of the decade of the 1990s and even up to this day.